Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing compassionate care and cancer specialists who are experienced in the cancer you have. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
And Cambridge Savings Bank. CSB is committed to improving the financial well-being of local small businesses through financial education and banking services. Learn more at cambridgesavings.com. Member FDIC.
Bridgewater State University is proud to sponsor this conversation from Boston Public Radio. More at bridgew.edu/gradclass.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, late last night, the news website Politico published drafts of a legal bombshell being dropped on abortion rights in this country. For months, analysts have speculated as to how the conservative-leaning court would rule on cases involving abortion. Now it appears we have our answer as the justice has set the stage for the overruling of Roe v. Wade. Later in the show, we'll speak with former federal court judge Nancy Gertner. But before we do, we want to know what your reaction is to the news and what you think America's reaction will be.
Celebrity chef Alton Brown on tour for his new cookbook, The Final Years. We'll chat with him about some recipe mea culpas, news of the return of Iron Chef to Netflix, and why so many are so transfixed by knockdown, drag-out kitchen battles. That and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. GBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday and Friday, from the Boston Public Library. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So we obviously start today with a bombshell leak from the Supreme Court last night via Politico, showing the draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade and the constitutional protection afforded abortion nationwide. Last night in Washington, as I'm sure you know, protesters from both sides of the issue converged on the steps of the Supreme Court. Here at home, state legislators have prepared for the moment, passing the Roe Act in 2020, expanding the right to abortion in Massachusetts. But what happens to that if Republicans control the Congress in 2022 and the presidency in 2024? A little later in the show, we'll hear from retired federal judge Nancy Gertner on the implications. But first, we're opening the lines and hearing from you to get your reaction to this leak from the court and the potential decision. Are you worried about the court's ability to overturn other legal precedents, gay marriage, contraception, etc.? Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. As you now know, that's not just our phone line, it's our text line, 877-301-8970. And you can email us at bprwgbh.org. You tweet us at BOS Public Radio. And by the way, later, the great John Waters is going to join us for a change of pace in person. You might want to join us down at the Boston Public Library for that. So what was your first reaction? You're one of those people. You and I have talked about this for our 20-some years on the air. You were among those people, as was I, who thought that they'd never go this far.
I never thought they would go this far because I thought that there would be a revolt among the women of America. But they have gone this far, and they didn't waste any time in getting there. I mean, this was written in February, just weeks after they heard the Mississippi case. You know, there's a real sadness to me here. Nobody likes abortion. Abortion is a very sad situation. But it shows a disrespect for women. That the government is going to step in and make decisions for women. As Ruth Bader Ginsburg said so many times, there is no economic freedom for women without reproductive freedom. And as we know, it's women that hold the bag here. We don't give women adequate help with childcare. We don't give women adequate maternity leave. There are deadbeat dads all over America who don't pay the dime for the support of their children. It is such a sexist disrespect for women, and it's the tip of the iceberg, as we will talk about all during the show today. The same premises on which Roe v. Wade is based is the same premise on which the Griswold decision involving birth control is based.
Obergefell
involving gay marriage is based. Loving is based, having to do with interracial marriage. So are we going to get rid of birth control and interracial marriage and gay marriage under the Supreme Court, too? And these conservatives are going to be there for years and years and years. So that's my reaction. What's yours?
I sort of knew this was coming, but you know how when you know something bad is coming, it's different when it actually does. And I was pretty shocked. And by the way, people like Nina Totenberg, who is arguably the most respected Supreme Court watcher, says this does not look fake. It looks like a real right. draft memo that would be circulated amongst the justices or between the justices, whatever it is, of the Supreme Court. She thinks it is totally legit. And by the way, we should say that while there appear to be five votes for this, apparently not with Chief Justice Roberts, along the way, they can change their minds, but the conventional wisdom is the five Republicans are locked in. A little bit later, we're going to play for you the, how should I call it, the misdirection testimony from three Trump nominees to the court on the issues of precedent. But you know what you should play first? One of your favorite senators is Susan Collins. You've all heard this. Here is Susan Collins from Maine, obviously, discussing the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. This is way back in 2018.
I do not believe that Brett Kavanaugh will overturn.
Precedents are overturned all the time.
He says for a precedent, a long-established precedent like Roe, to be overturned, it would have to have been grievously wrong and deeply inconsistent. He noted that Roe had been reaffirmed 19 years later by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and that it was precedent on precedent. He said it should be extremely rare that it be overturned, and it should be an example.
So you have obviously full confidence.
I do.
So is she naive or is she a collaborator, Marjorie? What do you say?
I don't know, but it is not worked out certainly as she predicted. You know, John has made me a little bit happy. He says, I'm going to change it a little bit, but he says, is it any surprise that the two justices accused of sexual misconduct, that would be Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas, don't support a woman's right to control her body? That's an excellent point, John. Thank you very much. But you know who else I blame here?
Who?
Democrats. Republicans have been so strategic, they have fought nonstop. And by the way, all the big evangelicals, Southern Baptists, they used to be pro-choice way back when. But when the Supreme Court made the decisions about integrating schools, clever strategists way back then decided that this wasn't really a good rallying point for their fellow Christians to rally around little black kids not being able to go to good schools with little white kids. They switched to abortion. And that's what this is about. This is about they're building up all these years' battles against abortion.
Well, they never take their eyes off the prize.
And they talked about the Supreme Court over and over and over and over again, and Democrats don't.
A text from 1775 touches on something we want to mention before we get to your calls. Democrats control the House, Senate, and the White House. They need to pass a bill to protect abortion nationally now. Now, they could do that. And to do that, they would have to carve out an exception to the filibuster, which it appears Democrats do not have it in them to do. Now, Marjorie, the question for you is, if the Democrats don't do it, and so far Senators Sinema and Manchin have not been willing to do it for anything from voting rights on down, if the Republicans take control of the House and the Senate, do you think the Republicans will carve out an exception for abortion and with 50 votes send a bill to President Trump's desk in 2025 outlawing abortion in every single state? I do.
Yes, I do. And we've talked many times about how abortion rights are safe in Massachusetts. Well, it appears that they're not safe now if we have a Republican president and a Republican House and Senate mm-hmm. in 2024, which could vote a federal law to ban abortion, which would override legislation in states like ours, which have codified, or I suppose we often say in the Roe Act, codify the right to abortion mm-hmm. or enshrine the right to abortion. It's not safe here either in those circumstances. So, I mean, I can't imagine what this could be like. And, you know, the other thing that so many people point out from the one good thing is that medical abortion is so widely available. It's going to be very hard to
open up. We talked to that woman a few weeks ago.
Open up people's mail to mm-hmm. find out. But those only work in the very early weeks of pregnancy. And unfortunately, lots of people, particularly young women who may be victims of crime or victims of incest, don't even realize that they're pregnant. And a lot of these anti-abortion legislation in these states don't even make an exception for rape or incest. But the thing is, rich women are going to be able to get abortions at least until they outlaw them completely. You may have to fly to Ireland, ironically, or something after that. But under this, because the states like ours will still mm-hmm. have abortion. But poor women won't be able to get them. And young women won't be able to get them. And it's pretty horrible.
877-301-897 to text us, as tons of you are doing, or to call us, as Melissa from Florida is doing. Melissa, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I called because I just hope everyone understands, and I'm sure you know many people do, that this is just the first cut. So if the Republicans take control of the House and the Senate in 2022 and then the presidency in 2024, they will have total control, just like they have in Florida. So what happens in Florida, you can take a look here and see what's going to happen around the country. For example, DeSantis has always opposed protecting people with pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. He signed on to Trump Care, which weakened protections for pre-existing conditions. Then his governor, he signed a bill that would that said that if Obamacare is repealed or done away with somehow, that the Florida health insurance bill would not limit what insurance companies could charge people with pre-existing conditions. So that's what you do when they're in total control. And right now, Obamacare is being attacked on the federal level. You have Republicans talking about repealing it. Like, you know, Bobby Jindal said that Republicans want to repeal it. You have Rick
former
Scott
governor of Louisiana, for those who don't know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. You have Rick Scott, who was, you know, he's a senator from Florida, who he says he wants to, you know, sunset federal laws every 5 years. And that includes Obamacare. So, and then he's also talking about raising taxes on people, you know, the working class. And
Melissa, I hate to interrupt you. Melissa, all you're doing is what Marjorie described before. The Republicans know how to fight. The Democrats don't know how to fight. I want to repeat, the Democrats today could carve out an exception to the filibuster on abortion rights, pass the same bill protecting the right to reproductive freedom that the House has already passed, deliver it, I don't know, today, tomorrow, Friday, to the desk of Joe Biden, and he'd sign it. Which would eviscerate the impact of the likely Supreme Court decision in June. Not constitutionally protected, but statutorily protected. The Democrats won't do it because they play a different game, sadly. Melissa, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
You know what's also worth pointing out? This is government by minority opinion because about 60% of Americans want Roe v. Wade to stay. It gets a little squishier when you ask them about earlier weeks. There are many people that don't feel so great about going up to 24 weeks. They'd rather have 20 weeks or 18 weeks. But and nearly, we looked it up this morning just to double check. One in nearly four women, or a quarter of women in America, who've had will have an abortion by the age of 45. So that's that's your mother and your grandmother and your sisters and your daughters. That's one in four. What they did now, I mean, what's going to be the penalty here? Do we know? They just jailed a woman in Texas. Right? Because she was trying to get an abortion.
Southern Texas,
is
that's
that
correct.
Is that what's going to happen?
Well,
one
you know,
of four
also,
American
you know
women
you know
are going to face
not,
jail.
You know what you're not mentioning that you said repeatedly on the air that is just as significant to me in the grand scheme of things is when was the last time the court in this country took away a right that had been established for 50 years in this country? One of the reasons why I think you were pretty confident that this would stay was because it had been a precedent for 49 years, 50 years, that sort of thing. This, as you say, sets a really... And for those who say, well, they're not going to go after gay marriage, they're not going to go after contraception, those are the same people who said they weren't going to go after abortion, and apparently they are. Let's go to Patty.
They're already going after abortion. Remember the fights in Obamacare about coverage of abortion? What it is a religious majority in the Supreme Court, Catholics, unfortunately, foisting their religious beliefs on the entire nation.
Let's go to Patty in Salem. You're next on Boston Public Radio.
Hi there. I think this should become a vote in the national referendum.
Well, there isn't such a thing as a national referendum. 26 states like Massachusetts allow voters to directly pass laws or changes to their constitution. The federal government does not. The only national referendum we have is when we vote for a president and a vice president, Patty.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I don't mean to take the wind out of your sails. I wish we did. But by the way, it's not just abortion. You mentioned the 60%. How many items are there on the list of what Americans care deeply about? Gun rights.
Right.
That, I mean, reasonable gun reform, protections like background checks, that the Supreme Court is on the wrong side of?
Well, the Supreme Court and the Republican Party. I mean, it has become minority rule, and it's going to get worse because of gerrymandering. And, I mean, we'll see what happens in 2024. It's certainly not looking good for the Democrats in 2022, never mind 2024. Val from Gloucester just emailed and said, don't anti-abortion supporters judges realize making abortions illegal will not stop them? Unavailability just makes them more dangerous. And that's
of course,
a very
that's
good
exactly
point.
Right.
That's a very good point. A lot of women get very sick. Some have died, as we know in the past, or they damage themselves irreparably by trying to do this. But the one bright light, again, is the medical abortions, that you can get abortion pills through the mail.
You know,
and I think it's going to be very, very difficult to go through people's mailboxes looking for what they're getting in the mail.
One of our colleagues tries to clarify what Melissa from Florida, she wanted to clarify that she was directing her call to independents and Republicans. I'm directing my call, Melissa, to Democrats. Democrats have the power today to pass federal legislation protecting the right to choose. If they don't, then I think the rhetoric is pretty empty. Lisa Nacar, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just want to say Marjorie is spot on that the Democrats don't know how to fight. But I have two comments. The first is that in the book of Genesis, life is described as, you know, a baby's first breath. So it has nothing to do with 6 weeks, heartbeat, anything like that. But I also feel very strongly that if you're telling a woman that she needs to carry this child full term, you're telling a woman that she needs to put her life at risk for a potential life. And I don't think if the discussion was ever, like, can you force a man to give up a part of his liver or a kidney for a distant relative to save his or her life? And it doesn't make any sense that, to me, a woman's life is just... That's what we're told to do.
Lisa, thank you much for the call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, even I just mentioned the Catholics in the Supreme Court. Catholics used to think that you could get rid of a baby up until the point of so-called quickening, when a woman could feel the baby, which is pretty far along, usually about 5 months into pregnancy. Anyway, we were talking about...
You know, before you go, vis-a-vis Lisa's point, remember the great line from Flo Kennedy?
What was the great line from Flo Kennedy?
That if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament, which I think... Is,
you know, there are some people who are sincerely concerned about this because they are concerned
some.
About the unborn.
Some.
But the anti-women animus undermining this. And I can't help saying this is true in so many areas. We have a president who was just elected when, 24 women had accused him of some kind of sexual mm-hmm. assault, including rape. The president is now supporting a guy out in Nebraska who has been multiply accused credibly by women by name of sexual assaults. It is really difficult to pursue these kinds of things. We just went through the Me Too moment or movement, whatever you want to call it, when all these thousands, tens of thousands of women came forward. And, you know, a lot of people just want to say, hey, they're all lying. So there's a real animus toward women here that really is kind of tough to take. Anyway, we're going to talk about this for a little while longer. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. And by the way, we are streaming on youtube.com/, or is that forward slash, Jim? I think it's a backslash.
Slash.
It's a slash.
Forward.
/GBH News. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from the Boston Public Library and streaming on YouTube at youtube.com/GBH News. We're going to talk about this with you a little bit longer. We're going to talk to you about this at the end of the show and in between at noon. We'll have former retired judge Nancy Gertner joining us to talk about it as well. If you're just joining us, we're taking your calls and texts about the leaked draft decision from the Supreme Court. Politico published it. And the majority's potential decision to overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade right to a legal abortion in America. The number is 877-301-8970. We referenced before, Marjorie, the either naivete or collaboration of Susan Collins in Maine. Here's a compilation of what Amy Coney Barrett, nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, nominee, and Neil Gorsuch had to say on the issue of Roe v. Wade and judicial precedent during their confirmation hearings. This is put together by the digital news outlet, The Recount.
Is Roe a super precedent?
How would you define super precedent? And I'm answering a lot of questions about Roe, which I think indicates that Roe doesn't fall in that category. And scholars across the spectrum say that doesn't mean that Roe should be overruled. But descriptively, it does mean that it's not a case that everyone has accepted and doesn't call for its overruling.
As a judge, it is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent, which itself is an important factor.
Senator, as the book explains, the Supreme Court of the United States has held in Roe versus Wade that a fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment. And the book explains that.
Do you accept that?
That's the law of the land. I accept the law of the land, Senator, yes.
So I guess you could say that Coney Barrett was not being deceitful as compared to Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Is that a fair statement?
She was evading, I guess, as much, or she was being much less direct. But, you know, I can't help thinking that Coney Barrett, who has 7 children, I think a couple of them are adopted.
They are.
She kind of acted as if it was no big deal for a woman to give a baby up for adoption.
Right.
And, you know, having been a reporter a long time and interviewed women who gave babies up for adoption, this is something that haunts women for their lives, wondering what happened to that baby. Did the baby turn out okay? Where did the baby go? This is no easy, oh, I'll just have the baby and give it up for adoption, and everything will be fine. I can't believe that she lives in such a bubble, being a mother of 7, that she would be so naive about that.
You know what's also amazing? Is
or wrong hard, about that, not it's naive,
hard,
just
it's
wrong.
It's hard to step back from this for a minute, but this is all coming at the time that there is an assault on democracy,
yep,
and defense of an attempt to overturn an election,
right,
by the vast majority of one of the two major parties in this country. Add to that the imminent overturning of the right to reproductive freedom, which has been the law of this land for 50 years. You can go on and on and on down the list of how the essence of what this country is supposed to be is really just being taken away from us, not in small chunks, but in large
ones. Well, I think that's why many people, when you talk to people that look at the United States of America, they think we're losing our democracy. And, you know, I mean, it does look a little dim at the moment. You know, Eric makes a great point, too. A lot of people think that abortion is about a bunch of teenagers getting abortions. The main reason that women get abortions is poverty. Most women who get abortions have already had children. They can't afford another child, and that's why they have an abortion. And people say, oh, well, what about birth control? Well, birth control sometimes fails, but the hypocrisy of the GOP, they want to get rid of abortion, but they also want to get rid of Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood is the reason there are fewer unwanted pregnancies than ever in the United States of America, because poor women, teenage women, go to Planned Parenthood to get birth control. They want to get rid of that, too.
Here's from a text from 1744 that I think is for you, Marjorie. The majority of sponsors and advocates for an abortion are Christian fanatics. How is this ban not an establishment of religion by the state?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we talk about freedom of religion in the United States of America, which is supposed to be freedom from, you know, the state's not going to impose any religion on you. Isn't this what this is? The state imposing the religion of Amy Coney Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch,
by the way,
et cetera, and Alito.
On the other hand, 8799, a text says, don't blame this on Catholics. Many Catholics are pro-choice.
That's a very good point.
Across from one. By the way, another friend of ours has another thesis in terms of the Democrats, particularly Biden, that if the Equal Rights Amendment were in the Constitution and all it requires is Joe Biden calling the archivist and saying you got to publish it, then the Supreme Court would have an insurmountable hurdle vis-a-vis the Constitution. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Lynn with Maggie. Hey, Maggie.
Tim, Marjorie, as I sit here and listen to the two of you, you've taken all the thunder out of my sails here, all the wind out of my sails.
Sorry.
Blow it back in.
What I've been saying is the people in charge, the people who think they're in charge, don't have a battle against women. They have a battle against anybody that can't control, anybody that differs from their opinion. And if this goes through, then women will not only lose their right to their own body, they will lose the right to vote. We've already seen the loss of voting rights being spread throughout the country. We will end up just like in The Handmaid's Tale. There will be no progress. There will be... This will be dystopia.
Okay, so Maggie, what are people in this country, not just women, but men who support their rights, assuming people believe this is the decision or very much like the ultimate decision that's going to be released in June, what's the reaction going to be from those people who feel that The Handmaid's Tale is upon us? What are they going to do?
Well, I don't know. I think that what somebody said earlier about women turning out to vote in droves, I'm hoping that will be the case. I'm hoping that people will go down south or to go to these states where, you know, it's illegal to hand somebody a bottle of water or a snack if they're standing in line to vote. I'm hoping that people will organize bus drives to get people to vote. If we don't stand up and fight for ourselves, they are going to take things away. And what I would like to see is if they're going to take away women's right to birth control, then if you can identify the father of each baby, then I think castration is probably an ultimate solution.
Thank you for that. I want you to know, Maggie, that's the first applause you got from the audience here at the library. Thank you for your call. By the way, Maggie makes a really important point. It may be obvious, but I think it's really important to make. If the reaction to this is modest on the part of the fair-minded American people, it is an invitation to the crazies to do anything they can to anything. If we don't stand up to this right being taken away, why do all the other rights you described a couple of minutes ago, why would they not go after them as well?
Exactly. I think that this is the beginning of, I don't mean to say the end, but the beginning of a very bad trend. I mean, we have millions of Americans who believe this ongoing lie about elections being stolen and these lies. I mean, it's just really discouraging. You know, Mackenzie, one of our staff members, just wrote about talking about a family trauma, having a grandmother who was, quote unquote, disappeared to an unwed mother's home in another state pre-Roe, then made to give up her daughter, is far more traumatizing than an abortion would have been. And that's what did happen to many young women. They had no choice, oftentimes didn't even see the baby. It just whisked away, and that was the end of that. And that is obviously very difficult. Teresa from Arlington, thank you for calling.
Hey, Teresa.
Hi. I don't know if you'll be happy with what I have to say, but this happening the day after you guys had Stephanie, whatever her last name is, on, who trotted out her idea of the Republican Party being about pro-small business, small government, and all these other things, when in reality, there's no longer a Republican Party. There's a Trump Party. And it consists of people who use pro-Christian, anti-democratic, pro-corporation, racism, and use cultural issues to control people, which creates a lot of noise, while at the same time the billionaires in that party are using every legislative method, every lobbying method to keep as much of their money as they can with no taxation. And all this other stuff is just meant to cause confusion. And then the people like you today, Jim, mm-hmm. who said that they can do this today, the Democrats can pass a referendum today, they can eliminate the filibuster or stack the court or whatever would enable the Democratic Party to get legislation through. Don't you think those people have done every poll known to mankind, checked into everything, trying to see if it would work, and they're not doing it because they're afraid of losing too much of the electorate?
No, I don't.
The
majority
of
the electorate actually is on the side of protecting the right to choose. I think the mansions and cinemas are just convinced their money and a critical piece of their constituency supports their obstructionism. I don't buy that at all, Teresa.
And by the way, Teresa, I think you were talking about Jennifer Nassour, who was on yesterday talking about...
Jennifer, yeah.
I mean, fairness, the GOP has been historically a party of smaller government and lower taxes and less government intervention. And it's worth pointing out that when Roe was passed 7-2, five Republicans were in that seven-person
majority. I totally forgot it was
majority.
7-2.
So it was five Republicans that voted in favor of Roe at the time. The Republican Party, I think you're right, the Republican Party, unfortunately, in many cases, has turned into a Trump Party. But I think Jennifer was talking about the kind of Republican she had been, which is a small government kind of person. Anyway, we're going to get back to this in the noon hour. We're going to be joined by a retired federal judge, Nancy Gertner, and she is an expert on all these things. We're going to talk to her. But we are going to switch gears right now. We're going to talk to celebrity chef Alton Brown. He's returning to host Iron Chef. He's got a brand new cookbook out. We're going to take a quick break, talk about food for a while, those wild Iron Chef TV shows. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We're broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming live on YouTube.com/GBH News. We're taking a brief abortion break. We'll be joined at noon by retired federal judge Nancy Gertner to discuss that more. But now, for a break, we're joined by Peabody Award-winning TV host, chef, author Alton Brown, whose new cookbook, The Final Years, is out as of last week. He'll be speaking this Thursday at the great Somerville Theater, an event hosted by the great Porter Square Books. He joins us now via Zoom. Alton Brown, fresh off a star turn on Colbert last night. It's a pleasure to have you. How are you, Alton?
Thanks. Thanks very much. I do want to point out it's called Good Eats 4.
Good Eats 4.
Final Years.
Very good
Just
point.
Saying the final years makes it sound like I'm dying.
Well, I thought
you look very, very healthy, Alton.
Yeah, I feel pretty good for dying.
Good.
Anyway, sorry for my surroundings. I'm actually having to do this in a bathroom because of renovation noise on the other side of the building.
That's okay.
That's the oldest excuse in the book, my friend. But okay. Nice to see you.
I'm looking in here.
So, Alton, tell us, you mentioned it's the fourth series. So you've done the fourth book because you've done many cookbooks before. So why is this different?
Well, this is the wrap-up book to the program Good Eats, which we had rebooted a few years ago. And so I wanted to make sure that I had all the new material in one book to kind of, encapsulate the entire Good Eats, era, I suppose. So this is the fourth book in that series, which... takes in all of the show Good Eats Reloaded and also Good Eats The Return.
By the way,
there's one thing that is really special here. Sorry about the sirens.
No,
that's
okay.
It's New York. Is that we were going to be doing a third season of Good Eats Reloaded. Budgets never got worked out, but all the recipes did. So all of those recipes are in this book, which have never been seen before.
You know, by the way, I made the fish sticks last night from the cookbook. I'll give you a review in a couple of minutes. I'll give you a hint. They were fabulous. One of my favorite foods as a kid. I haven't had them in years. But, you know, you and I have something in common. You're probably not aware. You write in your introduction, when you look back at your earlier work, you see yourself as an irritating gas bag, which is what people see me as today. So I feel there is actually a link that makes me feel very close to you. This book, in part... Alton, is an apology tour. Is that a fair way to describe at least a part of what you're doing
no.
here?
Yes, no. I'm not apologizing. That's kind of like saying, I renovated my house. I'm sorry it didn't used to look great. No, I mean, at the time that most of these, at least for, of course, the two seasons of Good Eats, The Return that are in the book, those were brand new seasons. I got no apologies for that. The others, the what we call the reloads, was simply me wanting to go back with new ingredients that are now available, new things that we know about food science, and simply renovate and remaster those dishes. It wasn't that they were bad. I mean, there were a couple that were bad. There were a couple that were really bad, but only a few that were bad.
Yeah.
We just won't bring those up. So I think it's more about renovation and updating. And the fact that I look at recipes as something that are never, ever static. They change. Our cooking levels change. Our cooking skills change. The audience reads recipes different ways. And of course, there are a lot of ingredients that just 10 years ago were really, really hard to get that we now have because of the internet. So I don't think of it as an apology. There's a couple of two recipes that I'll apologize for. But everything else, I think more of is nut grain.
Okay, come on, let's get them out of the way. What are the two recipes? One's the lasagna, obviously, right?
The slow cooker lasagna was universally hated by all. And then the other one was a pot roast recipe that actually, it's not that the dish was bad. It just had a bad name on it. I should not have put olives and raisins in a dish I was calling pot roast. If I had given that dish like olives an Italian name, everybody would have loved it because it's really good. But when you think pot roast, I know what I should be tasting in my mouth. And I did not, I wanted to be provocative when I did the original recipe. So what I really should have done is I just should not have called it pot roast. I should have called it braised Italian beef with olives, and then everybody would be like, oh my god, that's so good. But I called it pot roast, and that was a mistake. So I have amended the book with a pot roast recipe that is actually what people want when you say the words pot roast.
We're talking to Alton Brown. The new cookbook is The Final Years. It's out as of
Good
last...
Eats 4, The Final Years.
Good Eats 4, yeah. The Final Years. That's right.
Guys, so it's right on the cover. Just look, read
right.
The book.
Good Eats 4, The Final Years.
You're in a library.
Years. That's right. I'm gonna blame my staff here. They should have put this in. I'm going to blame them for this. But anyway.
No. Blame yourself and
okay,
then
I'll blame myself.
Them.
I'll blame that's myself. But I want to ask you, because I was watching some of the goodies from back in 99, you know, Pantry Raid, and the one you had with your grandmother about baking the biscuits together. And it was so different than these frantic, frenetic things I see on television now. And I kind of liked, I mean, well, tell us the history of this, because it did seem to me it was kind of homier in the original TV cooking shows. You know, you're there with your grandma, you're making the biscuit, she's just throwing everything into the bowl. I love that. And Iron Chef is a great show, but it is frantic.
All I can tell you is that I made Good Eats for myself. It was the cooking show that I wanted to watch. No one would make it, so I did. And I never thought about trends. I never thought about what the market would bear. I just made the show that I wanted to make. And I'm kicking things. And for me, that meant having comedy because I want to be entertained. I do believe that laughing brains are more absorbent. You can actually teach people if they're laughing. I wanted there to be actual know-how involved. And for me, that means bringing science in. And then I also wanted it to simply be practical. But you know what? If in the end, if people don't want to watch it, they're not going to learn anything. So coming up with a pacing and kind of a vibe in general that would bring people back repeatedly to watch the show became what that was kind of about. But to be really honest, I didn't give it any thought. I just did it.
Yeah.
Well,
but
speaking of, I'm sorry, go ahead, Margaret.
But they are really huge now. I mean, people adore cooking shows. They watch them.
Wait, you don't mean cooking shows. You mean cutthroat cooking competition. That's
cutthroat
what you're talking.
Cooking competition.
Yeah. Yeah. There are not many cooking shows left anymore.
Yeah. So what is that about? Do you think that's just what we like to see on
TV?
Not my
decision. I think that what happened is when a network like Food Network really went mainstream and became no longer a niche network, it had to compete with what was going on larger networks, okay. Which at least say 10 years ago was all about reality television.
Yeah.
And also about competition. So I think that what they've done is they've now built a model where they know what that audience is. And because they're part of Discovery, and Discovery is very much a reality TV structure, that's what they do. I have departed that network. I mean, you might have seen the announce yesterday that we're now doing Iron Chef on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And I very much wanted to follow that show because it is the one competition show that I have learned a lot from and wanted to continue doing. So I decided to depart Food Network, which had been a really great home for me, in order to be able to make Iron Chef on Netflix. But one of the things that I'm looking at now is that I want to continue making cooking shows. I don't mind competition. If it's fun and watchable, I don't find most of them to be that. And I don't see why real education has to be separated from entertainment.
So we're talking to Alton Brown. Since you mentioned Iron Chef coming to Netflix, when in June, July, when's that happening?
June. We're going to drop on June 15th.
Here's a little piece from the trailer. Here it is.
Feeling hungry, old friend? Hungry for battle! What a coincidence, because that's exactly what's on the menu.
It sounds pretty combative to me. Can we go back to, I'm watching Colbert last night, and you're on with some contraption called Jet Fry Jr., which looks like one of those things where you put the lottery balls in, like 40 years ago. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Yeah. And you bring out one of your coworkers who's spinning it around because you need Colbert on the Wheel of Heat. Could you describe what the Wheel of Heat is for a second, please, Alton Brown?
Well, the Wheel of Heat is simply a giant spinning wheel of hot sauces. Mm-hmm. And my thing is that I wanted him to compose a very unique hot sauce for his wings based on spinning the wheel several times. And actually, when they edited it, they cut out one of the spins. He spun three times. So we brought together three different hot sauces of various Scoville ratings, various heat ratings, in order for him to have a curated special sauce
okay.
for his wings.
Well,
which cooked, by the way, in 5 minutes. I just wanted to mention.
It was brilliant. They looked good, and he looked happy. I have two questions about last night. One, the Scoville rating, I think I heard correctly, I was a little bit tired, on one of the hot sauces was 600,000. Is that correct?
No, it's closer to 680,000. It's 678,000.
And Cayenne is like 30,000, right, or something like that?
Cayenne's for kids.
Okay, excuse me. So this is...
There are a couple sauces on there that are literally military-grade weapons.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. And you couldn't eat that straight on something. If you hadn't mixed it with a mild...
Some people can. I have tasted it, and I'm here to tell you I don't want that experience again. But, you know, if you're using it as an ingredient with other things,
okay,
you know, it can be tempered and become more of a flavorant. And so it's not just, like, insane, but, you know, by itself...
I thought, and one other question from last night's appearance, you stuck a whole wing in your mouth and you said to Colbert that the appropriate way to eat a wing in the South, and you didn't use these words, but it was essentially to pop the whole thing in and then strip it with your teeth. Is that, and all that came out were the bones. Is that what you're trying to convey?
I think that's exactly what I conveyed.
And is that, work with the, I mean, there are two kinds of wings. There's the flat wing kind of thing.
It only works on the flat.
That's what I wanted to be
clear. I mean, if you're really, really good, you can do it with a drumette. But, you know, yes, I did choose a flat for that particular demonstration of oral skill.
So to speak.
I can do it. I can do it with a drumette. I do it with a drumette, but it takes longer. It takes about 10 seconds.
We're talking to Alton Brown, whose new book, Alton Brown, his new cookbook is Good Eats the Final Years.
Good Eats 4.
I'm goofing this up all over
the place. We're getting closer and closer every time.
Okay. By the end of this, we're going to have this down.
That's right. That's right. Only three or four times will I get it wrong more. But I want to ask you, how did this happen for you? How did you get into this back in the days when there were no Iron Chefs?
I was directing TV commercials. And before that, I was a cinematographer. I was directing TV commercials, and I was cooking in all my spare time. And I would watch cooking shows. This is in the late 80s, early 90s. And
what'd you watch then? Do you remember?
Sorry?
What did you watch in the late 80s, early 90s?
Oh, I was watching these shows on PBS and stuff. And it was just, you know, at the end of a half hour, you'd have a recipe you'd written down. And I knew nothing. And they were boring. And I was like, somebody needs to make a food show for like the MTV generation. I need some visuals. I need some storyline. I need something. And nobody did. And so I finally got it into my head. Well, I could do that. And so I quit my job and went to culinary school. And, you know, it took a few years, but we finally made the pilot episodes for Good Eats in actually 1997, and then sold it and started making the show in 1999.
And you always loved to cook.
No, I actually really started cooking in college to get dates.
Oh, really? How'd that go?
Exactly.
You know what? In the end, it just turned out to be yet another thing I could do by myself that was enjoyable.
By myself. You know, by the way, you know, it's an incredible coincidence. You mentioned that show way back when called Good Eats. Were you aware that your latest book is called Good Eats 4,
Good
The
Eats
Final
4,
Years? Did you know that?
Years.
It's incredible.
Yes,
yeah.
So, yes I did.
Alton Brown, when you go to the great Somerville Theater, and it is great at an event hosted by
Oh, no, I've been there before. It's a fabulous
Oh, you have?
Stage.
So what are you doing? What do you exactly do on a stage for
well,
the attendees?
You know, I'm the guy that's just finished coming off a very elaborate roadshow, live stage roadshow. It's just, I'm going to talk and I'm going to answer questions. It's going to be a conversation with the audience. I mean, the reason that, you know, this kind of event takes place in the theater and not a bookstore is that typically bookstores are small and don't have room for that. And it packs everybody in too tight. And there's been a bug going around. I don't know if you guys.
Yeah.
We heard about it.
Yeah, we did.
So
yeah.
Doing it in a larger space helps to kind of mitigate some of that. But it's just going to be a very intimate talk.
Did I read, are you living in Georgia now, or you've lived in Georgia? Did I read that?
I do. I live, my wife and I are based in Georgia, and we're in our New York apartment right now, but our bases of operation are just north of Atlanta.
So you're the perfect person to ask. I'm big into pairing of certain foods with certain events. What would go best with an indictment of Donald Trump in the grand jury in Atlanta, would you say?
Peach pie.
Peach pie.
That would be, that's actually...
And by the way, I like to actually chop up very fine bits of mint to put in peach pie because I like the herbal. So it literally is peach mint.
That's a good
but
one.
Bummed. That's Thank
very
you
good.
Very much. You're talking so,
are they
Brown.
Saying that's going to happen, by the way? I've been on book tour.
Well,
I don't think so.
Well, don't say that. The DA in Atlanta yesterday is not Alvin Bragg in New York.
Okay.
She seems to be quite serious.
So what do you make of the state of cooking today? And everybody's getting, not everybody, but so many of these people are getting their styrofoam with all the ice inside, and they're getting these meals they can cook at night with a little spices in there. All this kind of stuff that was never around. People are into food in a way that certainly when I was growing up, they weren't.
Well, I think that we have to look at the state of food through the COVID lens. I think that a lot more people are cooking at home, clearly, and a lot of people still want that feeling of being served. So the best way to do that is to order a meal kit, which kind of removes the grocery store, you know, and removes having to make decisions, and you just kind of assemble it. And I think that for a lot of people, I'm hoping that that'll be an introduction to what I'll call real cooking. And of course, it is real cooking. If you're applying heat to food, you're cooking. Okay, so no judgment there for me. But I think that the best thing that can come out of all that is that people will go out in the world, look at the food available in their community and start to really interact with that, with whatever they have in their grocery stores and their farmer markets or their CSAs. So that attention that's being placed on an acquisition is not a bad thing. I just hope that it becomes more something that can be locally expressed rather than, you know, click, 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 order.
So Marjorie and I are borderline obsessed with food photographs. Did I read somewhere that you actually, I think for the first time, correct me if I'm wrong, did you do the photographs in your book?
I did a lot of them. I did a lot of the food photographs. And then another gentleman that works with me had done all the behind the scenes and any of the food that was shot on the Good Eats set. I did kind of the more artsy stuff.
Well, speaking of artsy, I'm a little nervous even asking this because you're going to tell me this other guy shot the photo. There's a photograph of pasta in the middle in this book. Do you know the one I'm talking about where they're all different lengths and they're hanging down? Do you know what I'm talking about?
That was me.
That was
yeah,
you?
Sure.
Are you proud of that or no?
Yeah. That's
it?
Very proud of that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I think it's a great photograph.
It really says what needs to be said about pasta, sort of, don't you think?
To me.
Now, also,
this is what I wanted to say about
Alton,
pasta.
You see, we only have a couple. You seem to be totally unimpressed that I made fish sticks from your cookbook last night. Is that a fair?
No, I'm actually, I wanted to get back to that.
Okay.
For a couple of reasons. One, yeah. I adore fish sticks. I have great memories of them as a child.
Me too.
And I like to make more modern versions of things. I'll be really honest. If I go and eat the fish sticks that I had as a child, frozen ones, I mean, they're not very good. My palate has grown since then. But I do believe in making something that is quality that reminds you of the things that you had as a child. And I was actually, you know, really trying to nail fish and chips, and realized that what I really wanted out of my fish and chips was fish sticks. And I don't think that it's a hard recipe.
So,
what did you think of it? And not only what did you think of eating it, I want to know how you felt making it.
One, I felt great making it. Maybe not for the reason you're – well, maybe one of the reasons was because it reconnected me to what I used to do as a kid, is throw 12 of them into an oven from a box and pop them in with a little ketchup. And you were totally right.
Yes.
They were 1,000 times better. And when you have a new iteration of something you once loved that is the same but almost totally different, if that doesn't sound oxymoronic to you – it is a total thrill.
You've nailed something, which is that you by updating something, you can completely miss the original point. That's the danger of updating a dish like that.
So I was watching one of your old Iron Chefs last night. I think Mario Batali, before he got in trouble, he wasn't the chef. It was these two guys that were making buffalo. Some Bobby Flay, I think one of the guys was, and Chef Bayless. Remember this? Well, anyway, they had.
I don't remember this. You had like 300 of those.
You were the star.
I don't know where my keys
are.
She remembers them.
That's all that matters.
Well,
what's your point,
Marjorie? You may not remember, but I just wondered, is it fun? Is it fun for you to do those shows? Because they are running around like lunatics with these, trying to make dinners out of buffalo.
Yes.
And they've got 17.
Iron Chef.
Yeah.
Iron Chef is a huge amount of fun for me. It takes a huge amount of study because I've got to be ready for anything that hits the counter. But I get a real rush. It's like a sporting event. It's like calling an NFL game. And so I get to be kind of a sportcaster. It is a real blast. And the new version is so much fun on Netflix that all of that came back to me plus more. It is fun. It's a completely different kind of fun than Good Eats was, because Good Eats was completely scripted. I mean, I wrote all of those.
Really? I didn't. So you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell.
You couldn't?
Good writing.
I couldn't tell.
Give the Peabody back then, I guess.
I thought it was spontaneous.
Hey, we're almost out of time. Where do I find the recipe for peach mint pie?
I don't actually have that online, but, you know, maybe I'll get around to it.
I hope you do. Alton Brown, we're looking forward to the Netflix thing. The cookbook is terrific, and good luck Thursday night.
What's it called? What's the book?
I believe it is called Good Eats for the Final Years. What do you think?
You know what?
Well done. I knew we would get it before.
I knew we would do
it. Fifth time is the charm here at Boston Public Radio. We're a little slow in the uptake, but we finally get it.
And you didn't even stop to raise money.
That's incredible.
We
will.
Thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations. Alton Brown is a TV award-winning celebrity chef and host of both Good Eats and Iron Chef. His latest book, Good Eats for the Final Years. You can catch him in person this Thursday at the Somerville Theater, an event hosted by Porter Square Books. For more information, including how to get tickets, check out portersquarebooks.com. Coming up, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner is going to bring some legal clarity to the leaked Supreme Court draft decision on Roe versus Wade. Nancy Gertner is up next after this brief break. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library, and we are also live streaming today. Jim, you know where we're live streaming?
No, I don't. Where is that? YouTube.com/GBH News. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we'll begin hour two with former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who will bring reaction and insights to the leaked draft of the overruling of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. Then we'll speak with Amari Paris Jeffries of King Boston, which just broke ground on the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial on Boston Common, known as The Embrace. He'll also bring us up to speed on all the rest of King Boston's plans.
John Waters at the Boston Public Library to talk about the 50th anniversary of his famed film Pink Flamingos and his brand new novel, Liarmouth, a feel-bad romance. Executive editor Jared Bowen on a controversial new exhibit at the MFA, and Prison Nation, a powerful exhibit of photography at the Davis Museum in Wellesley, and more. Stick around, all that ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday and Friday, from the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. We're also streaming on YouTube.com/GBH News, but that's no excuse for not being here. As you obviously know, a bombshell leak from the Supreme Court overnight indicates that five very conservative justices are poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, ending nearly 50 years of nationwide legal access to abortion. At 1:30, we will again take your calls and comments on this apparent decision. But first, joining us now to help us make sense of what that could mean both here in Massachusetts and beyond is Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge for the District of Massachusetts, now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, a regular contributor to Boston Public Radio. And she has a book coming out imminently and very relevant for today on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for your time.
It's good to be here.
Yes, thank you very, very much, Judge Gertner. So, were you surprised by this?
I was surprised by the leak. That's unheard of. I was surprised by the venom of the decision. There was at least a discussion that this could have been cutting back on abortion in some way, that where they would approve the 15-week
right.
bar. But not say abortion is over. This is a flat-out, facial attack on Roe v. Wade. It's a critique of the decision. It has the earmarks of an opinion that Alito has been writing for some time. That it has implications that are very troubling, because to be sure, abortion isn't mentioned in the Constitution. Nor is privacy mentioned in the Constitution. And all of the rights that Roe v. Wade engendered, right to privacy, to birth control, to, the ban on, lifting the ban on interracial marriage, all the rights that came about that were concerned with the right to make decisions about families without the government intervening, those rights are at risk because of the scope of this decision.
You know, Nancy Gertner, could you give us the gist of the reasoning that Alito lays out for the majority and then tell us why you think he's wrong?
Well, what he does is he's an originalist. And so he says a couple of things. He says, one, abortion isn't mentioned in the Constitution. Well, nothing is mentioned in our Constitution. The Constitution is a very general document. Women aren't mentioned in the Constitution. The Constitution, in fact, assumes that the polity would be composed of men and white men at that. So the fact that it is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution doesn't say anything. This is a Constitution, as Ginsburg would say, for all ages and not just for the 18th century. So that was one reason. Then he literally went back over the history of abortion and said, well, you know, it had been criminalized in the states in the 19th and 20th century. That's a little inconsistent with his originalist point, because the issue was whether it was criminal in the 18th century when the Constitution was written. So he basically says, if it's not there explicitly, we can't interpret the Constitution to include it. The implications of that are enormous. The Constitution as a general document is calling for limitations on the government's interference in our lives, mm-hmm. and in particular in the kind of unique decisions whether to bear or beget a child. So the reasoning really casts doubt on 50 years of constitutional law. The other thing is it's upholding a statute without a rape or incest exception. Think about this.
Yeah.
A young woman who's raped by her father is obliged to carry the baby. What no other industrial country enables that. The third thing is it does say that individual states will be able to, state legislatures will determine whether abortion should be illegal. Thankfully, in our country, in our state rather, because of a decision actually that my husband, John Reinstein, and I did, the abortion cannot be barred in Massachusetts. It is protected under the Massachusetts state constitution. So
explain that to us. Explain that to us in terms of the Constitution, because we talked earlier this morning and the sources we checked just focused on the only protection being in the Roe Act, which was passed over Charlie Baker's veto in late 2020. And as I'm sure you've been reading and thinking, the conventional wisdom is that if members of the Republican Party retake the House and the Senate and a Republican is president in 2025, and they carve out an exception of the filibuster, they pass a national law outlawing abortion. Your contention is that our state's constitution would protect women seeking abortions in our state? Could you make the case?
Right. It depends on what they do, on how they do it. But let me go roll back the clock a minute.
Sure.
Every state has its own constitution, and in fact, our constitution predates the federal constitution. The state Supreme Judicial Court has really since the 60s been interpreting our constitution in some ways differently than the feds are interpreting its own constitution. And abortion was one example. Abortion was felt to be protected under the guarantees, the due process and equal protection guarantees of the state constitution. So with that protection, Congress can't say abortion is now, let me put it this way, Congress can't pass legislation that would criminalize abortion because it would violate the state constitution. There will be litigation, I suppose, about which provision trumps which provision. There could be litigation with respect to that. The more dangerous statute, the more dangerous piece of legislation would be if Congress declares the fetus to be a human being. That would create federal protection for the fetus that could arguably collide with the state constitutional protection. But otherwise, if they simply ban abortion nationally, there would be a collision then between the higher protections that state legislation, state constitutions offer and the federal constitution. We are entitled to be more protective under our constitution than the U.S. constitution. The only exception, I said, would be if they said the fetus was a human being.
Judge Gertner, I am reading all over the place today, though, and hearing from legal scholars that if the Congress passed and the president signed a federal law that could stop women from seeking abortions going to different states or even overrule, now they say legislation in Democratic-led states. I think you're saying that legislation is different because of the Constitution?
No, she's saying that what the language of what the federal government would do would determine whether our Constitution prevails. Is that not where you're going, Judge Gertner?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So let's think about different levels here. If our state legislature, not likely to happen, says that abortion from now on is illegal,
right,
that legislation would be trumped by the constitutional protection for abortion in Massachusetts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If the Congress, however, passed a statute that said abortion is banned across the country, that would be litigated, but presumably the Massachusetts Constitution is allowed to give greater protections under its constitutions, under its constitution than the federal constitution. For example, the death penalty is illegal here mm-hmm. under the state constitution and not federally. The only problem would be if Congress went so far as to declare the fetus as a human being. That would then set off, that would be saying that under the federal constitution, the fetus would be entitled to greater protections than the woman who carries it.
Understood. We're talking to retired federal judge Nancy Gertner now at Harvard Law School.
Judge Gertner, as Jim said, you've got a book coming out in a month, The Opinions of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As you know, she had some problems, expressed problems with how Roe was decided. I think she thought it would be better under a gender equality kind of thing. Explain that.
Well, she said that she wanted to situate abortion under as part of an equal protection argument. In other words, the right to bear or beget a child is essential to a woman's equality. If you don't have a choice about when you bear or beget a child, all the other protections of the Constitution and of the statutory law would be worthless, right? If I have no protections on when I'm going to have a child. So she saw it as a larger equal protection analysis. That was one critique. The second critique was she believed, unlike these five justices of this court, she believed that the courts should proceed slowly, just as she did in her litigation, you know, carving out the right over time as opposed to a single decision announcing it. There's a wonderful line in one of her speeches where she talks about the importance of the Supreme Court moving in measured steps, as she did in her litigation. This is not a measured step. This is pulling the plug in a fundamental way to this protection. So she disagreed with a single decision suddenly changing the law across the country. But she believed, she agreed with the underlying principle, albeit under a different rationale.
You know, Judge Gertner, I'm going to try to scare up like a smidgen of hope that is probably ill-founded. This morning, first of all, as you say, unprecedented, apparently ever, at least in modern times, that a decision is leaked. And I'd be curious in a minute to know what you think that does in terms of the justices' relationships with each other, with their clerks, et cetera. But number two, much to my equal surprise, when I assumed the Supreme Court would say nothing about it, the Chief Justice has confirmed that this is the real deal. This is not a fake, which suggests to me, this is the hopeful part, that the only reason he's doing it is because he wanted it. He's okay with it being out early enough for pressure to build on one of those five conservative justices to flip. Is that naive on my part?
I'm so perplexed by all of this. The one theory that I heard was that the leaker was Clarence Thomas and that he was leaking it for the purpose of shoring up his majority.
I see.
So one possibility is, for example, that the other justices in the five-person majority might have wanted to go slowly.
I see.
Texas is okay at 15 weeks, but no bar earlier. To do it slowly. We don't know what we think about Roe v. Wade, but this passes muster.
Uh-huh.
The other, you know, with Justice Roberts, I don't know. I don't think that there's much chance of the five changing the outcome, although the rationale may be different. It's perplexed. I mean, if I'm sounding perplexed, it's because I am perplexed. These are justices who swear up and down that they're not affected by public opinion, and yet someone leaked this exactly to inflame public opinion.
Yeah, one way or the other. We're talking to Judge Nancy Gertner.
It's hard to know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm perplexed too, Judge Nancy Gertner, as I often am. what would it take for Congress to give the status of personhood to a fetus. I mean, we've just seen this, which many of us thought could never happen. How far-fetched is the former, the personhood thing?
You know, could Congress pass such legislation? Yes. Would the president sign it? Depends on who the president is.
Right.
You know, it would be the functional equivalent. It would be the, just as Dred Scott took away personhood from African Americans wrongly and outrageously, this would be conferring personhood on the fetus and essentially, in my view, taking it away from women.
But what gives either of you, what gives either of you the thought that a Republican Congress that was willing to overturn an election and support insurrectionists would not be willing to? I think they'd do it in a nanosecond, Judge Gertner.
Well, because there at least was a political discussion that the court would never straight out, flat out reverse Roe v. Wade, because it was a better mobilizing. Because once it was done,
they own it.
That's right. You've lost the mobilizing potential of the issue. So, and in addition, the public is overwhelmingly against reversing Roe v. Wade. It's one thing for the Supreme Court to do it, but it's quite another thing for Congress to do it.
Excuse me for interrupting. CNN is putting up a poll right now from January. Support Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. 69% no. Only 30% yes.
Wow. This is a 50-year-old precedent.
Yeah.
And one reason why it was sustained in 1992 with the votes of three Republican-appointed justices was because of the sense that you don't undo, you don't take away rights. The analogy to Plessy v. Ferguson, the case that found that segregation was okay, which Alito compares to this. Plessy v. Ferguson was egregiously wrong. Roe v. Wade was egregiously wrong. There's a fundamental difference. The fundamental difference is we have never in our history taken away rights that have been conferred on 50% of our population. That was essentially, reversing Plessy v. Ferguson and Dred Scott was creating constitutional protections, not taking them away. And that's what this is about.
We're talking to retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, who's got a new book coming out about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, we talk a lot, and we have been talking more frequently about religious freedom in the United States, a lot of court cases that go to the Supreme Court about religious freedom. As a layperson with, and I am a Catholic, we've got six Catholics on the Supreme Court, it looks like we're having a religious viewpoint imposed on the entire country here. How is this not mixing up state and church?
Marjorie, only you can say that. I'm perfectly serious. Only you can say that. There's certainly a sense that I have, not being Catholic, that I don't agree that the fetus is a human being. That's a contested issue,
right,
in religion. That's a contested issue.
Yep.
And one of the things that the Supreme Court should not do is to take one side or the other of that. There was also a theme in the decision, which I didn't mention, is that it's no longer the case, Justice Alito said, that having a child out of wedlock is considered bad. And that resonated with a comment that Barrett made, that after all, you can have the baby,
right,
and then, you know, deposit him,
right,
in a, I forgot now, a fire station. I always thought that maybe it's a service
God.
Walgreens.
Yeah, just, right. No problem with that.
Right.
Yeah, just right, go right ahead, yeah.
But I think that discussion is a political discussion and not a legal discussion.
That's
a political discussion.
We have one more political discussion. I think regular listeners to our show know that you served on Joe Biden's presidential commission on the Supreme Court. We've discussed with you at least on a couple of occasions the whole term limit issue, the issue of expansion of the court. Does this provide any impetus for anybody who was not a Supreme Court reformer to become one, or is it a status quo ante, or the same place we were prior to yesterday?
Well, I mean, it's hard. I think that the Supreme Court decisions, Supreme Court issues are bigger and deeper and should not be affected by a single decision. There's no question about that. But what this decision reflects is something that I said when I was on the commission. They are doing this because they can. Mm-hmm. Period, full stop. They are doing this because they can, because there are five of them, because they don't need Justice Roberts' vote. And they got to that position by, in my view, three illegitimate appointments. They got to the position where they had this kind of power because Trump packed the court. So somebody said to me the other day about the White House Commission report, would I feel differently if Scalia had passed away during the Trump administration along with Justice Ginsburg? And I think I would. What this has shown, the Gorsuch appointment, Kavanaugh, Barrett, are the flaws in our system, the fault lines in our system, that they can undo what they have got, they've undone and will undo, by the way, just because they can. No institution should have that much power. In fact, Jim and Marjorie, I predict that by June, there will be no right to choose abortion. This will become law. And the right to carry guns everywhere. That's an agenda, which that will have been done by a group of justices who are proceeding to undo precedent at breakneck speed just because they can. And there's something wrong with an institution that can do that.
You know, Justice Ginsburg, this isn't really a legal question.
She would be Judge Gertner.
Judge Gertner, what do I call her? Justice Ginsburg.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
They were buddies, but not
former
the same.
Former federal judge, Nancy Gertner. You are not Justice Ginsburg. I'm so worked up here. But I just want to, you know, you, like me, grew up in the days before abortion was legal, and we all heard the stories, friends of mine in high school, people I've known all my life, women that died. What's so awful about this to me is just the incredible disrespect that this court has shown the women of America. It's like we've taken so many steps backwards. I just wondered, you know, what your feelings are about that.
Well, it's the government in charge of your uterus.
Yeah.
A friend of mine with whom I write op-eds sent me an email today and said, what if a state criminalized vasectomy?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, who's going to say what to that? The post-Roe era, if Roe is overturned, yes, we will see some of the same horror shows we saw before, except for one thing, and that is medical abortion.
Yes.
Marjorie
yes.
mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier. Yeah.
Medical abortion will enable women of means to have abortions everywhere in the country. Now, there are states in the South that are now trying to limit medical abortion in their states. One other point which we haven't mentioned or sort of touched on, this is not just abortion. This is birth control.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the rationale of that decision goes all the way to birth control, to the laws that grew up, not laws, but decisions that came out of a case called Griswold versus Connecticut, which dealt with birth control. And what that decision led to was Roe v. Wade, the prohibition against barring interracial marriage, gay marriage, all the complex, the skein of rights that came out of our view that the Constitution protected personal privacy. That's what's at jeopardy here.
Do you believe
it's not just women, it's really everywhere.
I was about to say, do you believe we're even having this discussion
no,
in 2022?
I can't.
Judge Gertner,
can't.
We know you're really busy. We really appreciate your carving out time for us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge. We're very, very grateful she took the time to be with us today. She is now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and we are, again, really grateful that she was able to join us. Coming up, Amari Paris Jeffries leads the nonprofit King Boston, which just broke ground on that Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial on Boston Common. You may have heard about that, seen the picture of the day. He's going to join us after a quick break to tell us what's going on with King Boston and other projects he's involved with in the city. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and Friday from the Boston Public Library.
Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, as we are every Tuesday and Friday. You can see us streaming online at youtube.com/GBH News. In about 20 minutes, a lot of you are asking, the legendary John Waters, out with a brand new book today, will be joining us today live. But first, last week, the nonprofit King Boston broke ground on Boston Common for an impressive new memorial. It's called The Embrace to Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. Here's Boston-based singer and songwriter, my apologies, Imani Music, performing at the groundbreaking.
I was born by the river in a little tent, and oh, just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a
good there. We're joined now by Amari Paris Jeffries. He's the executive director of King Boston, a program of the Boston Foundation. It's working to create the Embrace and other programs. We'll talk about the life and legacy of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King. And he has come bearing gifts. Unlike Mayor Wu, who brings pastry, he brought us a terrific book, Coretta, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, by Coretta Scott King. Amari, it's great to see you.
Great being back. I was worried about all of our health, so I figured this would be...
better than pastry.
Way better than pastry.
That's your opinion.
Food for the soul.
So tell us, for those people who have missed this whole phenomenon, what's going to go on? What's going to happen at Boston Common?
Yeah, you know, it is a wonderful memorial honoring Dr. and Mrs. King and honoring 65 other distinguished Bostonians. And so, as you know, there's been a moratorium on the Common for the last 30 years. And so we fortunately, through the partnership with the city, got that lifted. And so we snuck in two for one, a memorial for the Kings and a memorial for Boston.
Have you disclosed yet who those 65 people are going to be?
Coming up soon. I think in the next couple of months we'll unveil those leaders. And I think, you know, we know who some of them are. There's some staples of Boston civil rights community, like Amell King, like a Hubie Jones, like a Melnia Cass. And so some of those, we can expect to be there.
You know what I remember? I don't know. I assume you were here. The Boston Public Library, about maybe 100 feet from here, displayed the five finalists for memorial. Do you remember
that?
I do.
And
yes.
I have to say, I don't know if we've ever asked you this. When I saw The Embrace, and they were all pretty good, by the way, The Embrace, to me, was up here. My hand is way up in the sky. And the other four were good, but not there. Was that your choice? If you were the chooser?
It was my choice, and I'm glad that I didn't have to be the sole chooser of that. You know, there were a lot of opinions about The Embrace, but I think when you think about this moment, the timing couldn't be better. The thing that most of us have wanted to do in the pandemic, missing our friends, missing our loved ones, missing our coworkers, is to embrace. And so a symbol like The Embrace couldn't be a better symbol for Boston in this moment. Maybe we could be the city of embracing each other.
When's this going to be done?
So we unveiled it on Mrs. King's birthday, we had the groundbreaking on Mrs. King's birthday last week, and we plan to unveil it on Dr. King's birthday next year.
You know, we often talk to people who've written about famous historical figures. The one that comes to mind most easily is Doris Kearns Goodwin, and one of us always asks something like, do you feel like you actually know Abraham Lincoln? Not everything about Abraham Lincoln, but do you feel like you know Abraham Lincoln? Do you feel like you know the Kings?
You know, I feel like I'm getting to know them better. I think we grew up thinking about Dr. King as this mystical figure, and we saw Mrs. King in the pictures, but she is a hidden figure in plain sight. And so when we thought about this moment where we're illuminating Hidden Figures, we knew that we had to include Mrs. King in this memorial. Many people don't know that they met here. Their love story began in Boston, right? They fell in love here. Their first date was on Mass Ave, you know, around that area. They had many dates in the Commons. So I think those are the pieces of their story I didn't quite know until I took on this incredible responsibility and privilege.
And I'm from here, and I didn't know it
Nor
either.
Did
I didn't know that she was at the conservatory and that she was a stellar musician or all those things. I mean, all of her, you're right, her life was not featured in a lot of the things we learned about Dr. King.
That's right.
But tell us, there's a lot going on here. We talked to Reverend Liz Walker and Paul English a while ago about this whole thing, and money was starting to come in, but you've raised a ton of money. So congratulations
Thank
to you.
You. Thank
what are you,
you.
Going to do with all that money?
We've been fortunate. You know, we realize in this moment in time during the pandemic and the racial reckoning that, you know, organizations looked at King Boston, you know, while we just started, they looked at us to really do something to respond to what was happening across the city. And so alongside of the memorial, we're creating a center of community, culture, and economic justice in Roxbury. And so we have plans, knock on wood, to be one of the recipients of Parcel 3 and build the center there.
And you that's know, I near wanna, the, that, I was just going to say, that's near Melnia Cass and the police headquarters, right?
That's right. It's the last urban renewal parcel not developed in the city. And so when we remember the Orange Line used to be an elevated, now it moved to Central Southwest Corridor. It's the last undeveloped land. And so I think to end this legacy of urban renewal, to end this legacy of displacement of communities that were housed, that were neighborhoods there, to have a King Center, to have a Center for Economic Justice located there feels like the culmination of the scar right down the center
and
of
what will
Roxbury.
That be? What will be the Center for Economic Justice?
And so
be?
We see it being a community meeting spot. You know, we're in the work of cultural representation, so this museum, this place to connect Roxbury to downtown, this place to illuminate black culture in Boston, that's often, again, underappreciated, often hidden. In plain sight. And so those are some of the things, those are some of the features we hope to place in the Center for Economic Justice.
I want to talk a little bit more about that in a second. I want to get back to money. When we first talked to Reverend Walker, and yes, it's the same Liz Walker who those of you of a certain age grew up watching every single night on television, and Paul English has founded a ton of things, probably most notably Kayak. Paul gave $1 million to start this thing. What's the pay? I mean, we know what this came after. Nationally, obviously, after George Floyd's assassination. But we know right here in Boston, the Federal Reserve study showing the average wealth of a white family, 250 grand, average wealth of a black family, and you always have to say, no, it's not a typo, $8. The survey of African Americans across the country with eight major cities in the Boston Globe, which is the least welcoming, we won, in quotes, by a landslide. So against that backdrop, what's your pitch been that has been obviously so successful because you have raised a ton of dough? What do you say to people? What's the marketing thing, for lack of a better expression?
Definitely not the championship banners we want to hold up in our city. we're a city of winners, but that's not one of them. You know, Boston is one of America's storytelling cities. You know, the others are arguably Philadelphia and Washington. And so when you think about what it means for these storytelling cities, many of us get the story of America from Boston, the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Massacre, Paul Revere's ride. Boston can be the storyteller of America in a different way. We could tell a new story. And so this family from Kansas that comes to the Boston Common to walk the Freedom Trail, they see the embrace, they talk to different people, they have different experiences. It tells a new story about America. And so as we think about America post-pandemic, Boston has the unique opportunity and responsibility to tell a new story. And so part of our festival, which is the week leading up to Juneteenth, is really imagining how does America celebrate Juneteenth and center black folks. And so I think that's why the festival is on Juneteenth week, because we think Boston has an opportunity to lead the way to celebrate this unique black holiday, but create inclusive ways for all of us to celebrate it.
Talk about that celebration. Then I want to return to what Boston is like in 2022. It's 5 days, right? Is that what the deal is?
It's 5 days. You know, it's at a different location every single day. First day at TBF, second day Harvard Medical School.
The Boston Foundation.
The Boston Foundation, yeah. Third day at the ICA. fourth day at GBH. GBH is hosting the day That's on great. Reparations. And then the last day at Mass Art with a block party in Nubian Square. And so we want people to come to Nubian Square. I think part of the idea is to create a sense of welcome in spaces that regular average citizens have not felt welcome. They haven't felt like they can go into some of these spaces. And so that's part of it, but also to create an opportunity for dialogue and discourse on this week of Juneteenth.
You know, you talked about the history and the storytelling here. I don't know if these happen at the same time, too. I'm embarrassed to say I can't think of the Harvard professor who did the research, which I'm sure you're familiar with, maybe 6 months ago, about segregation, social segregation, shopping segregation, not just housing kind of thing, but where people of color live, work, play, totally different from white Boston. Which, and then Philip Martin did an incredibly powerful series on GBH, our colleague, interviewing a handful of African Americans who had lived here, who basically said, I've had enough. And I think all of them, or most of them, had moved to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Or some southern
away from here.
City. What's the pitch that the story, to use your expression, Amari, that counters those troubling trends and stories?
Well, you know, if you're into comic books and you know there's a Marvel movie that's coming out this Saturday, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse, right? And so if that's your thing, it's definitely my thing, taking my kids there this Saturday. You know, we understand there's a multiverse, but there's a multiverse in the 60s and the 50s where the kings came here and they entered a city that was welcoming. They entered a city that was inviting. They entered a city that said that you belong here. And those same kings made Boston the center of the national civil rights movement. And so we're in that multiverse now. In 2022, 2023, we have an opportunity right now at some university in our city. There is a Dr. and Mrs. King falling in love, taking a walk in the park. And we want them to stay. We want them to say, Boston is a city where I belong. You know, former city councilor Tito Jackson said, you know what, the welcome to Boston card that all new Bostonians get is usually orange and says, you owe $45 for parking in the wrong neighborhood. That's the welcome to Boston card that people get on their cars. And so we have this opportunity to keep the future Dr. and Mrs. King who are somewhere at some university in our grand city that might be a BPS student, that might be one of us, that might be here in the studio in the audience, to say, I belong to Boston, and I'm going to double down in this city. And so that's the opportunity for Boston. 2030 is our 400th anniversary of a city. And so what could Boston be by our 400th birthday? And I think that's the pitch. What could we be by our 400th year?
Do you feel, can you credibly say that things are already changing? We have a woman who's a person of color who's the mayor. We have the Emancipator, the BU Globe Project.
Right.
We had the leaders on a few weeks ago. Last week was their sort of their coming out party. Look at the city council as compared to it. I mean, you can credibly make a case, not that we're there, but the change has begun in this city, no?
I mean, we're leading the resistance. We got Shigan Itowu as the chief of
economic. He was here this morning. Yeah.
So, we are leading the resistance, right? And so when we think about conceptualizing reconstruction, right, some argue that we're in the midst of a third reconstruction, right? So the first reconstruction happened right after the Civil War. The second reconstruction happened when returning GIs came back from World War II. Some say that we're in the third reconstruction. What's a reconstruction? It is the emergence of legislative and civic leaders. It is social change, and it's transformation, right? That's the final stage. We haven't seen a reconstruction through. And so Boston leads the resistance in this reconstruction. I think this emergence of elected and civic leaders are part of that transformation. And I would argue, let's go back to the election of Congresswoman Presley, right? As a part of this ecosystem of leaders, progressive leaders making the change.
I predicted she's going to be crushed by Mike Capuano, by the way. And we told Congresswoman.
So did I. Well, that was the big joke before. You know, everybody was Irish. And then we had, oh, my God, we had this whole run of Italians. That was just incredible that the Irish were supplanted. And now we've got people of color all over the place, young people, too, which is another big change, I think, in Boston. Now, how old is the mayor? She's 37 years old.
Just 37.
Yeah. Hey, tell me, one of the things I was reading last night about your time with the whole King thing is giving $1 million to the 12th Baptist Church, which is a great church in Boston. Tell people about 12th Baptist Church, why they were your largesse was landed on them.
Yeah, well, if you haven't met Reverend Bodrick from 12th Baptist Church, you'll know it when you meet him. He's a dynamic leader and I think really part of the cadre of Boston's transformation of leaders. But the 12th Baptist Church was also Dr. and Mrs. King's home church, right? Reverend Haynes, Reverend Dr. Haynes was one of Dr. King's closest friends, lifelong friends when they were up here. And so, you know, we had three mandates when King Boston emerged, really from community conversations. Erect a memorial. We're on task to do that. Hopefully, still intending to unveil it on MLK Day 2023. Stand up and support 12th Baptist Church with a $1 million gift. We've done that. And so the last part of our charge, at least the physical part of our charge, is to create the Center for Justice, the Embrace Center, and P3 is our intended location.
When we were reading the stories about P3 in the Boston Globe, it seemed, correct me if I'm wrong, that there are two major bids. One bid includes 30,000 feet for you. One bid includes 0 feet for you. Is that you wouldn't put it that crassly, but that is a major difference in the two bids, is it not?
Well, I read both of the bids. The other bid actually includes us indirectly. So also, we are, you know, they mentioned some of the programs and they say, hey, we want to include this with a partner like King Boston in their proposal. And so one we're directly involved with, and that's the My City of Peace HYM proposal. The other one we are friends with, right? Boston's a small town, and so a lot of the folks on that proposal are friends and mentors of mine as well.
Let me tell you, you are one positive character. That is, you see the... Yeah. You know, one last... I want to talk about one last thing that's happening in this town to add to the list of things I was asking you about. When Lee Pelton, obviously the head of the Boston Foundation, has been here the last couple of months, we've talked about their project on reparations. And in the middle of that discussion getting on, I spoke to him on TV the other night with Ruth Simmons, who is the woman that is running the Evanston, Illinois, the only government-funded reparations project in America, I believe, or at least the first right now. And against that backdrop, Harvard really made history the other day. I know a lot of critical people. You're not one of them. I know a lot of critical people, and virtually nobody had anything except praise for Harvard, except to say, obviously, the proof is in the implementation. Let's see, now that we've had the findings, which appear to be painfully honest, what do they do to try to address
some
this?
Some people, Jim, say that with their endowment of whatever it is, 40 or 50 billion, they could have
they
done
could
more.
Well, maybe they will.
Million.
But what's the impact that has on the perception? Well, both things, what the Boston Foundation's doing and what Harvard did. What's the impact on the, in your opinion, on the perception of this community?
Yeah, well, you know, Robin Rue Simmons will be at GBH for the Embrace Ideas Festival on Thursday.
Oh,
so
I didn't know that.
We will all be engaged in that conversation.
Great.
And meet her again in person. Excited about what Harvard is thinking about. I think there's an opportunity for them to model what it could be like to make past wrongs right. I think reparations is an empathy conversation, right? So what is it about making someone who says, I'm not whole, that we have a problem with, right? And so whatever, in all the ways that means making someone whole. And so we're talking about making a people whole and making African Americans, especially folks who are descendants of enslaved people, whole. And so what does it say about our society and the discourse that's happening where we just have a fundamental problem with making people whole, especially if it doesn't impact us in that way? And so,
except you know what the answer is. It does impact us in some way, says a 45-year-old white guy. I had nothing to do with this. I live in Evanston, Illinois. Why, when I think it's on the cannabis tax there, why should a nickel of my tax money go to fix something that I have absolutely no responsibility for? What do you say to that man or woman?
Well, not related to that day, but we're also bringing the author of The Sum of Us, this book that talks about zero-sum thinking. Mm-hmm. And so we've all been socialized to think, hey, if I benefit or this group benefits, I lose something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This group benefits, I lose something. And so Heather McGee's book posits that, you know, that zero-sum thinking is, you know, marked throughout our history, right? And so we talk about in the South where towns would much rather fill in swimming pools that benefit the common good than allow African Americans to join the swimming pool. And that book has tons and tons of examples. So we've been socialized into zero-sum thinking that the benefit of these people hurt me. so I have to block it. And so I think that's the conversation, right? It's not about this direct taking from me, but it's about the fear of someone else benefiting more than me, and that signals that I might lose something. And so that's what we got to change. And the monuments and memorials that we're creating is a part of that milieu, right? And so when there's Confederate monuments and memorials in your city, yeah. This talks about white supremacy. That talks about who's in charge. That talks about whose history is revered. And so we have an opportunity to change street names or imagine new street names that make us feel included, that make us feel welcome, that make us feel like not the city where we're number 10 most welcomed or the most economically least welcomed and economically disparaged. And I think some of the things that Boston has in place holds those up. And so we have to reimagine those things.
You know, one last question for me. You seem to be a totally calm, relaxed character. Don't you feel I'm serious. Don't you feel a huge burden? I know you're going to say it's a privilege. It's a great responsibility. I know you
all
believe
it. All right, I'll stop. I won't say
no,
that.
I know you. No, no, no.
You're sitting
in
a basket case.
No. I wasn't suggesting it was BS. I know it's heartfelt on your part. But essentially, after this tsunami of racism that this country and this city has lived through, so many people are visiting their hopes on King Boston, not exclusively. Obviously, there are lots of other projects going on too. But so much is invested in the success of your operation. What does that do to you?
Well, I have some team members who are in the audience. They could, if you had them up here, they could probably talk about what it does to me. But
meaning you're not quite as calm as you appear. Is that the point?
I'd say I'm mostly calm. My father, who recently passed away, was the youngest of 11, raised in Jim Crow South, and really sought his independence by enlisting in the Vietnam War. Right, that benefit from being a veteran paved the way for my family to move in the middle class, and ultimately for me to go to college. And so, I was raised with this responsibility and privilege to lift people up as I go. And so, I think I haven't had the platform or the vehicle to fulfill this mission. So not only I feel like am I honoring the city and the legacy of the Kings, but I'm also honoring my own father and my parents' legacy in this country.
Boy, have a hell of a platform. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So exciting about the groundbreaking, by the way. We are really excited, Amari. Thank you so much.
And by the way, when are we going to be able to walk down there and see the embrace right in the middle of Boston Common?
Martin Luther King Day, but maybe for a soda, I could take you for a sneak peek. In November. It should be done in December. And so we're waiting for the official unveiling.
We are there, my friend.
That's not long, actually. That's really soon.
It's quick. One last thing. There are 12 major 3D printers in the country, industrial 3D printers. We're using 8 of them. And so it's being fabricated right now, refined in Washington, stone in Wisconsin. So we're trying to support American companies through the building of this memorial.
We want that tour. What's your website, Amar?
It's kingboston.org, KINGBoston.org, or embraceideasfestival.org are the two ways that you can find us.
Can't wait, and we're really looking forward to that week, and we're really proud that GBH is involved. Great to see you.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for having us.
Paris Jeffries is the Executive Director of King Boston, the group behind this coming memorial for Dr. Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King on Boston Common, which you've been talking about. It is called, of course, the Embrace. The Embrace Ideas Festival is in June. You can get tickets and find out more information at embraceideasfestival.org. Thanks again to Amari Paris Jeffries for coming in. Coming up, the incomparable John Waters has a new novel out today. He's dubbed it a feel-bad romance. We'll talk about his new book after a quick break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Mardrigan. And we are live from the Boston Public Library. We're streaming on YouTube. You just go to youtube.com/GBH News. We're thrilled about our next guest, the Pope of Trash, John Waters. By the way, when the people of the Newsfeed Cafe heard that he was actually, they say, he's coming live? Well, you decide. In any case, he's the man behind Hairspray and Pink Flamingos. Pink Flamingos is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Here are the only 11 seconds of sound we could find that would be legally allowed to play on our show. Here they are.
Could you give us some of your political beliefs?
Kill everyone now. Condone first-degree murder. Advocate cannibalism. Eat Filter my politics. Filter's my life.
That would, of course, be divine. John Waters is also an actor, artist, and the author of a brand new book. I think it's out today, actually.
Yeah, today.
Liar Mouth, A Feel Bad Romance, a novel. John, it's great to see you again. Welcome
Good.
Back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're so happy to have you back here again, John Waters. So tell us, again, Jim pointed out it may be difficult to work around this, but essentially, what is Liar Mouth, A Feel Bad Romance? About.
Well, I'll give you the trailer. Here it is.
Okay.
It's about a woman that steals suitcases in airports. So, Marcia Sprinkle, scammer, children and dogs hate her. Her own family wants her dead. She's on the run with a big chip on her shoulder. She's dangerous until one insane man makes her tell the truth.
Well, that's sort of, you know, you left out one important thing, actually. Yeah. I've always believed that the key to a good novel is including a talking penis. Is that something you've always believed?
Well, here's the thing. Talking penises, I think, have been in other books, too. But never have you had a human with a gay penis and a straight head.
That's right.
They're battling with each other.
It was a difficult issue.
Richard, though.
That's not bisexual.
No, we
that's
understand.
Their, you know, they're in conflict.
Thank
but
you.
But I love the stealing suitcases. That's a wonderful idea.
It can happen. What happened? 9/11, they changed all the security for everything else and did away with checking the tags when you
that's
get your
right.
luggage.
That's right.
You could easily do it.
Yep.
I've almost picked up the wrong suit. Case, and that's all you say. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, until they're done in by a 4-year-old.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's true. But it really could happen. And so, and I also know somebody that used to always steal the flight attendant's pocketbook. And she told me that story because it's right in the same place when you get on the flight, which is a terrible thing to do.
It is a terrible thing to
Wait
do.
Wait a second. Did you just say you know someone who always steals the
well,
flight attendant's
Well, she used to all the time. And my friend said, I was with her, and I didn't know she did it. And then they said over the thing, all right, we're not taking this plane off till somebody gives back, like in school. You're not leaving here. And she didn't, and the plane took off.
Wow, very impressive.
But my friend thought, oh, my God, she did that again. She was sitting right with her, and she looked over at her.
He actually continues right to Provincetown, where you've spent considerable time.
I'm going there for the 58th summer in 2 weeks.
Yes,
you know, speaking of, can we talk about Provincetown? I see you. I've been in every summer in Provincetown for probably 35 years.
Yeah.
You, I shouldn't mention this other guy because I don't talk about him anymore. I used to live in New York City. The only man I never had the courage to walk up to and shake a hand when I saw him on the street was Woody Allen. This is before he was, you know what.
Oh, well, I was in one of his movies. I didn't give the money back. I already spent it.
So I see you riding your bike, and I'm about to say hello, and I say, you don't really want to. Do you
want to? No, you can say hello, but that's why I ride the bike, because when I stop, everybody wants to do selfies.
So you don't have to do it.
It's very nice, but still, it's like then I'm at work. So I ride my bike, and then I'm just zipping through. Now get off the bike. So, and I like riding my bike, though. That's my exercise. I feel healthy
right down
in Provincetown.
Commercial Street.
Yeah, well, as long as we mentioned Provincetown, you're doing this formal dinner thing in Provincetown. It's a prize.
Well, last year they had the big auction for the film festival, and I gave the prize was 10 tickets where I took them to, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the radio, which is the public sex place.
So, okay. Okay.
I took him to the public sex place. And we raised $17,000.
Ho!
For the 10 tickets. And it was hilarious because we all went on a bus and everything. So this year I had to think of something else. So I had 10 people. I'm taking him to dinner at the dump.
Dinner at the dump.
Town dump.
And we have a really great chef who's going to dumpster dive and go all. I just found out yesterday we announced this. The health department called him. The humor impaired health department, and John Darien, who does ceramics, he's doing all broken silk tableware, and the florist is doing all dead flowers, and it's at the dump.
Let
we raised $16,000 on that. Sex sells better, but
than a dump.
Yeah.
Why are you know? Getting back to the novel for a second, which is rather it's unlike most other novels I've read. You're a septuagenarian. You don't.
I'm 76. I'm not middle aged. I'm not going to be 152.
Isn't this your first novel?
Yeah, except you think about it, I've written, 14 movies.
That's a good point.
I've written in Carsick, the book where I hitchhiked across America by myself.
You were here for that.
Yeah.
I imagined the best rides and the worst. So that was fiction.
Baltimore to San Francisco. That was right. Yeah. So So this but sort yes. of, it is your, so what's it's up with that? I mean.
Why not? Same reason I challenged myself to hitchhike across America. My last book, I took LSD for the first time in 50 years. I'd like to challenge myself. At 80, I'm going to turn straight.
Where'd you get, I don't think that's happening. Where exactly did you get that jacket thing you're wearing? I don't mean thing.
It's very
it's
mother
gorgeous.
Of the bride. Isn't it?
Very much, very much.
Where's that? Izzy Miyake.
Izzy Miyake? Is that
that's a design.
Oh, sorry about yeah. that. So, wait, my favorite singer is Joni Mitchell. Yeah. And Joni Mitchell once was asked at a concert to sing A Case of You. And her response was, did anyone ever ask Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night again? Which I thought was great. Are you sick of talking about Pink Flamingos before we
no,
talk about it?
No, because it's coming out on its Criterion. It's putting out this beautiful new restored
yeah,
thing.
50th.
So I've been working on it all year. And we went to the locations where the people live now and doesn't know it and tell them about the hideous movie that was filmed in their house. And wait till you see what I do in one house. Divine's curse will live on.
Oh, so, okay. Okay. So I was reading, I think it was a story we did here at GBH, yeah, it was, about how what you want, we're not rushing anything, but what you want your obituary to say, and you said it should say that I made trash one bit more respectful.
1% more respectful.
1% yeah, more yeah. respectful. Okay, that's what I was put here on earth to do. So how did you evolve at this place, John Waters?
50 years, and thank all the great people that let me get away with this. I never had to get a real job in my life.
Nor
have we,
even
though my
actually.
Hours are longer.
Yeah.
I just kept trying to make myself laugh, and I made fun of myself first. And that's the only, I think I'm politically correct, even though I make fun of it. But the new self-righteous politically correct, that's the one thing they don't do. They don't make fun of themselves.
Yeah.
And I think you need to do that because yeah. if you're lecturing people, they turn against you. If you make them laugh, they'll listen.
So what was the little John Waters like?
I was obsessed by playing Car Accident. And my parents took me to junkyards to look at them, and I'd walk around thinking, oh, there's been a terrible accident. And, you know, now I'm terrified I'll die in one. You know, I don't look. But so I was always a weird little kid. I told my mother once, there's this weird kid in my class, and he only colors with black crayons. And I talked about him so much, my mother mentioned it to the teacher, and the teacher said, that's your son.
Oh, my
so
gosh.
I was creating characters for myself. Really
yeah.
early.
I don't want to leave Pink Flamingos so quickly. Yeah. Is it on the National Film Registry?
Yes. Can you believe that?
I mean,
yeah, a movie that I've never won an obscenity case in my entire life.
So I was thinking about you, obviously, when I heard that. I would be incredibly proud. Are you?
I am. With no irony, I'm proud.
With no irony. You
because
are.
I didn't change. Look at this book.
Okay.
The book is insane.
That's a very fine point.
It's as insane as Pink Flamingos.
So when you see
read,
Pink
though,
Flamingos
really quick.
Recently, 50 years in.
It's worse.
What do you... That was
it's
my question.
Much worse. And I know why I get found guilty, because at midnight, when people are on pot watching it, it's joyous. At 10 a.m., when you've just been sworn in for jury duty with strangers, and you have to look at a singing anus, it is obscene.
Beautifully
singing
put.
Anus. Yeah.
No, I know. There's nothing like, well, there is the penis, too. So the other thing that's rather incredible is
this.
I look at the cover of Town and Country, and I say, who do I think I would not see on the cover of Town and Country?
It looks like National Lampoon.
It does. Yeah, actually, yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah. By the way, that, your jacket is great. This is that a robe?
Yes, that was their clothes. Of course, it was a full
it's
fashion
gorgeous.
Suit.
You don't like that thing?
Yeah, I didn't get to keep it either.
So do you say to yourself, what am I doing on the cover of
no,
Town and
I think, isn't this hilarious? And they had the best, and they said they got great attention for that issue. They're trying to reinvent themselves a little. So I come in to cause trouble. But I respect good taste. My parents drilled it into me. I could have never had this career if I didn't know the rules to make fun of.
Well, it says the rules of good taste, starring John Waters, who broke them all. We were talking to John Waters, whose brand new book, Liar Mouth, came out today. Liar Mouth, a feel-bad romance, a novel.
You know, John Waters, you talk about people that are politically correct too often. They don't have the ability to make fun of themselves, and you have the ability to make fun of themselves. But you must take a lot of grief, too. I mean, you don't?
No.
Really?
Because basically, I'm making fun of myself, so I make fun of things I love.
Yeah.
I think I am politically correct. I make fun of the rules in the community I live in, which is never the mainstream. And I point out that sometimes the outsider world has more rules than my parents had growing up.
But that community you live in now is much more the mainstream.
Yeah,
than
that's
it
why
was
I said I don't
want to
be an outsider. I want to be an insider.
Yeah,
because everybody wants to be an outsider. Both Trump and Obama would call themselves outsiders.
That is correct.
Okay. So when I was young, that nobody wanted to be an outsider. So I did. Now that everybody wants to be, well, I want to be an insider.
On the cover of Town and Country.
Yeah,
as a
exactly.
Matter of fact.
It's the only radical thing left to do.
So with all this nastiness in the world of social media and everybody complaining about being harassed and doxxed and all these kinds of things,
yeah.
And in the climate, which some would say is becoming not just politically correct, but very conservative. You don't
snark. I don't read so much. I read the comments sometimes, but I don't. I'm not on Facebook. I don't care what you had for lunch.
Okay, so you avoid it.
Yeah, I don't read all the snark that would be about me. But I read the. You know, I know what people say, but I don't get attacked much.
You don't.
No, I don't. And if I was going to today, it would not. The censors I feared growing up were stupid old white people. Now it would be rich young people. They would
really?
Probably be the ones that would come after you for political correctness and stuff.
Oh, okay.
But I go even further. I say we should have, you know, fecal flash mobs to go out and really to show about pronoun police. Go even further the other way in political correctness and be funny about it.
So could this be a movie? Liarmouth and
it
Feel
could
Bad
be.
Romance?
It would be NC-17 and it would have a high special effects budget for all the trampoline bouncing. Yeah.
Can we talk
That's
about Providence?
The daughter Poppy.
Yeah.
Hey, John Walters, I want to talk about Providence Sound a little bit more. I may have told you this. I had a store. I had a head shop, leather store,
wow.
Record store.
That's right.
Maybe even, I don't know.
I'm sure I did go
ages
in.
Ago. It was a little red firehouse across from what used to be the now the library. It used to be the art, whatever the hell it was. This is a very, I love Provincetown, but it is a very different place.
It isn't
from,
to me.
Well, how so?
Because it was always expensive. It's a resort, and it only has 3 months to make the money year. It was always expensive. When I lived there, every penny I made when I ran the Provincetown Bookshop went to rent. It's more expensive.
You ran the Provincetown Bookshop?
For many years, and it just closed. You know, it's gone.
How
I
did
do
you
know
miss
this summer.
That?
I don't know. Yeah.
That
is
was the Provincetown. First job I had there was with Mary Oliver, the poet. She and her girlfriend.
We talked about Mary Oliver a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I spoke at her funeral with Hillary Clinton.
And wait a minute.
I did.
You did?
At her memorial in New York, yeah.
How wonderful is
and
that?
And Hillary was pretty funny. I didn't, you know, she had a sense of humor.
What she talked to you?
Yeah, we were backstage. We had to go on, and everybody else was saying Mary Oliver is such a poet. I said, I hated that awful little dog she had. And Mary caused trouble all the time. She did. She wasn't this little earth mother in the woods.
What did you say about her at her memorial?
I said that she caused trouble all the time. She was fighting with all the neighbors. That awful dog she had, it bit her. I hated that dog.
She was fighting
and
with the
neighbors? And people were stunned because everybody else was talking, oh, Mary in nature. I knew her the other way. She was great.
She was fighting about with her neighbors about what?
Always about anything.
Really?
She was always in some contention with the neighbors. Yeah.
I would never have known that.
Yeah. She was not so some little earth mother.
Out there examining all those beautiful flowers and all that growth. No.
And once she would go crawl. I said, if I see you crawling around the woods talking to animals, I'm calling the mental institution. And then she got bit by a beaver once when she tried to help him make its nest. And it bit her. I said, that's what you get.
So Hillary Clinton, I'm embarrassed to admit, I was thinking, do I have to admit this? I do, to tell the story. Hillary Clinton was actually at the Met Gala last night. How do I know?
I saw it too.
I looked at every photograph.
Saw her picture.
Pathetic.
I thought Lizzo looked good, fully covered.
Oh, my God.
Fully covered.
Incredible.
What happened to feminism? Why is everyone nude? Brad Pitt doesn't show his testicles.
No.
What?
No, he does
so,
not.
So what was my point there? There was a point. Oh, what did Hillary Clinton, does she know who you were?
She seemed like she did. I bet Bill saw Pink Flamingos. He might be the only president that did. Think about it. Which one?
We do think about it. Yeah. Okay.
He
fine.
Saw it.
Why'd you bring up the Met?
Because he said he hung out with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton
was
went to the Met.
I
in
saw
Gala
her in a red,
full
in a
drag.
Red,
yeah.
In a red
full
gown.
Drag.
Yeah. Well, they're all in drag at that. You can call it what you want.
But there were a couple. Were you talking about the woman that was all in black that was covered up? Is that who you were talking about?
Lizzo, usually she's like half naked, but she had a gorgeous outfit on, but she was fully covered. So did Naomi Campbell. No cleavage. You got to pay for that.
Yeah.
Why are you giving it away free?
What I always wondered is when they have the dresses with the 40-foot trains behind them.
They did last night.
Yeah. I know. I saw
them.
The pictures of them. I guess they just hold them up. Or
no, someone carries. That's the lowest level entry showbiz job. It's like being a fluffer in porn movies. You got to carry the train.
Don't tell people what a fluffer is. We know, but
they
really don't tell people. No, by the way, I think they did figure it out. We did not even know that Jared, who I think is our next guest, Bowen, is hosting your event tonight at 6 o'clock at the Brattle Theater for the Harbor.
Yeah.
So what do you do at one of these
things?
Well,
we have a discussion, yes, and then we sign books. No, I don't think we are signing books because of COVID or something. I sign all the books before. And then people
we are or we aren't?
We are selling books.
Oh, signing before we
but
just...
But then we have a discussion about the book.
Just not unlike this,
yes,
as a matter of fact. Okay, we're talking to John Waters. I want you to know that the woman who runs the Newsfeed Cafe, where you should get... Is Karen over there? Karen, there's Karen. Karen, what did you yell out what you said to me about your commute to work? Go ahead. She said the best train read she has ever had on the commuter rail to get to work is Role Models. Are you familiar with the book?
Thank you. Well, you had the audio version or the book?
No, I had the book.
Yeah, because I have the audio version of all of them. And I had to read this one. I realized how really dirty it was. And I had to read it out loud and look over at the technicians who were like, looking at me like that.
This is not for the faint of heart, but none of your stuff is for the faint of heart. You're
huge. Well, Hairspray was for the faint.
Well, that's probably true.
But people think of Pink Flamingos now and Hairspray is like, I mean, famous total classics.
Yeah, but if you watch Pink Flamingos today, no matter what they say
that
about
totally
it,
true.
It still is pretty rude.
Okay, so do you go to a ceremony for the National Film Rep? What happened?
No, I didn't go get a knighthood or anything.
Is there one, or you just chose to boycott it?
And it was also during COVID, too. No, I would have gone in a minute. Are you kidding?
Of course you would.
I never get a reward. I got the French Medal of Honor from the French government for promoting French films. I just wear that around my house
you
in my
Jerry
pajamas.
Lewis, is that like,
I love Jerry Lewis.
Love Jerry Lewis.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
John Waters, last time you were here, you talked to us about one of your previous books, Hitchhiking Around the Country. Just tell people about that, but they don't know about that book.
Well,
tell us.
Hitchhiked when I was 66 years old by myself from Baltimore to San Francisco, and I did it for real. And in hindsight, it was fun, but it wasn't standing there for 10 hours. But I had a good time. I mean, I really learned. I'm still in touch with three of the people that picked me up hitchhiking.
Really?
They didn't know who I was. And even if people, when they found out who I was, they thought, why would it be me standing on a ramp in Kansas? And one old man, they didn't believe. I said, I'm a filmmaker. They went, oh, yeah, sure you are, sir, and gave me $20. And I didn't want to take it. And he made me take it, so I gave it to another homeless person that was outside. And I was living in gas station lavatories like Pink Flamingos. And one day when I couldn't get a ride, I felt like I was taking a little sponge bath in the gas station bathroom.
So have you already got all 10 people? If you got the whole crew for Promise
and
all
that?
Oh, yeah,
we
said, yeah, 16,000 we raised.
Okay, so you can't, so for the dinner.
That's it.
Okay, that's it. Okay, no more.
Well,
okay.
I mean, maybe for $5,000 you could give them some money and sneak in. I don't know. But you don't get dessert.
Okay. Okay.
John Waters, before you go here, give me a little tip on how to approach you and stop you while you're on your bike not making eye contact on Commercial Street. What do I do?
Want to sign my book?
Oh, that does it.
Yeah, that does it.
That does it.
Yeah, Jim wants to.
Because MAP, my store there, my favorite store that has all my books in there and everything. It's a great clothing store, bookshop and everything.
Oh, it's a great store.
You know that place.
Oh,
she's
I do
my
very
dear
well.
Friend. So that's great. a great place. So I like to give her business, too.
It's a deal.
Jim wants you to stop for him so he can impress his friends and family this summer.
No, because it impresses me. John Waters, we are huge fans.
Thank you so much.
Is great, like everything else you've done. Congratulations. And congratulations on knighthood or whatever the hell happened to you with the National Film Registry. Let's hear it for John Waters.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
John Waters,
the
filmmaker, actor,
Waters.
Artist, and the author of Liar Mouth, a feel-bad romance, which is a novel, and it is out today, and it is really fun. After a quick break, we're going to be checking in on the state of the arts in the Commonwealth with GBH's own Jared Bowen, and Jared Bowen is going to be interviewing at the Brattle Theater tonight, John Waters, the Harvard Bookstore event, Brattle Theater tonight at 6 o'clock. Where do we get the tickets?
Yeah, how do you get tickets? Jared, when you come up here,
Jared will tell us how to get tickets
for tonight's event.
Okay.
He'll tell us in a second.
All right, coming up is GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen, the host of the Open Studio TV series. He's going to be with us on the Arts About Town. Jared Bowen is next. And again, thank you to John Waters.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library. Streaming on youtube.com/com. Easy for you to say, Jim. /GBH News. We're joined by Jared Bowen. Jared is GBH's executive arts editor, host of the TV series Open Studio, and host tonight of John Waters, at the Harvard Bookstore event at the Brattle Theater. He'll tell you how to get tickets in a minute. And by the way, his show opens studio. You can catch Friday nights right here on GBH2. Hello, Jared Bowen.
Hello, Jim Browdy.
Hello, Jared Bowen.
And Marjorie Egan.
So, Jared, we're going to revisit this again with you.
Oh, tickets first. Let's.
Oh, the tickets.
How do you get tickets for tonight's event?
For John Waters.
So it's at 6 o'clock tonight. It's the Harvard Bookstore. You just go to their website. You get tickets there, and the event's happening at the Brattle Theater. So we'll have a conversation. He just told me he's going to think up entirely new answers after the conversation you both just have. And then we'll take audience questions as well. So it should be fun.
I love him, by the way. He is so real and smart and funny and
so
wildly
smart.
Creative. Yeah. He is just really
Well, he seems
impressive
like he's also
character.
Very kind.
Very
I
kind.
Get that sense,
and a huge
too, yeah.
champion of the arts,
yeah.
in addition
it's
to film, but museums, and yeah. he just pushes everything forward. He's great.
In any case.
So, I, as I said before, we're going to revisit this again with you because it just opened at the MFA, but there's been many stories written, a big controversy about this Philip Guston exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts. What is the deal?
So in 2020, the four museums were supposed to be partners in a touring exhibition of the work of Philip Guston, and this was the first retrospective that was happening in decades. And Philip Guston, just by way of background, was a painter who came up in the United States. His parents were immigrants, actually from present-day Ukraine. And he was Jewish and experienced anti-Semitism very early on in his career when one of his paintings in Los Angeles was defaced, ultimately by a faction of the LAPD that was affiliated with the Klan. So this churned within Philip Guston for decades. And he also went to high school with Jackson Pollock. And together, That's they became amazing. Abstract expressionist painters, obviously in their own respective careers, and both hugely famous. But then, when Guston saw what was happening in the 1960s with Vietnam, the civil rights movement, again, really probably considering, I say probably because he never talked about his art, it's all interpreted, probably considering what had happened to him throughout his life and seeing the hate that was roiling in this country and that he had experienced in his own life and family, he decided to leave abstract expressionism. I'll butcher the quote, but he basically had something pretty profound to say about his explanation. What am I going to do? Go into my studio and change, I think it's a red to a blue.
Right.
So he needed to do something more with his art. So he left abstract expressionism behind, and he starts to go into these cartoonish images in this pink color. So it harkens back to the comics that he would watch or look at in the Sunday newspaper growing up. And they have these pink tones, so they're cartoonish, but also could be read as fleshy and raw. And he has cartoonish figures, including these hooded figures, the Ku Klux Klan. So flash forward, this is what he did for the rest of his life. The art world turned their back on him because they couldn't understand why he would leave abstract expressionism and do something that they couldn't regard in any high esteem. So this exhibition was to open, and of course this is in the wake of the George Floyd murder and protests, and the museums decided to pause the show. And this, they said at the time, was because they wanted to present the show in a time in which it could be more duly considered because of the subject matter and audiences who might come through and see depictions of the Klan without knowing the proper context. There was a huge uproar in the arts community. Jim and I, we spoke with Matthew Teitelbaum, who was one of the presenting museums. He's the director
of the
MFA. And they... The art world backlash was, if not now, when would you show this work? And doesn't the art stand for itself? Well, flash forward again to now 2022, and the Museum of Fine Arts is now launching the show. The other partner museums are MFA Houston, the Tate in London, and the National Gallery in Washington, which is where it was supposed to start. It's now starting here at the Museum of Fine Arts. And they have curated this show in a way that they have probably never curated a show before. They brought in a staff advisory team to advise them with all different viewpoints about what they see in the art. They brought in a trauma specialist. They added additional curators so they can have a wider curatorial perspective. And that's the show that you'll find on view at the MFA right now.
You know, I remember our conversation both with the head of the MFA and with you about this controversy. And by the way, the original notion was a four-year postponement, which I never understood. Now it was only 2 years. You'll explain that in a minute. I hope I don't get myself in trouble, but I never really understood. The only part of the controversy that I understood was that there was a lack of diversity in the curation of this exhibit at most of these museums, which I think is a totally legitimate point. But looking at the art, and I actually knew about him, unlike so many artists you mentioned, it's so clear he's condemning racism. There's no other... Reed, was it... When I say purely, I don't mean to disparage the consideration. Was it solely about the fact that a bunch of white guys were essentially deciding, or white women were deciding how and in what fashion this stuff would be displayed? And considering the sensitive nature of the subject, diversity made total sense, was a mandate. Is that what it was?
I think that was the overriding factor. I spoke with Matthew Teitelbaum about this recently, and he said if you ask each of the four museum directors, they'll all give you different answers about what the postponement meant. His point is Guston remains resonant for this time and all time. That's a direct quote from Matthew Teitelbaum when I spoke with him last week. But I think he recognized that museums were suddenly under fire in a way a lot of the arts are, for not being as accessible, for being so closed to various communities, for not being open. So his point was, let's do this, but let's do it right and bring in these teams. And one of the things that they do I think is interesting is there's a moment as you're working your way through the galleries where you will come across a gallery that has a majority of the paintings with the hooded figures. They couldn't eradicate them from all of the galleries because it was a motif that he included throughout his career, even in one of the abstract paintings called Tormentors that you'll find in one of the earlier galleries. But to see all of these images, they did concentrate them in one area, kind of recreating a Marlborough gallery show that Guston had, which he was basically run out of town for, again, for leaving abstract expressionism. But they have signage up, so before you get to that gallery, you have the option of going right to exit and circumvent the gallery and come back in a different way, or you're prepared for what you're about to see. And what you will see is Terrence Washington, one of the guest curators, as he explained to me, they wanted to create a very claustrophobic space. They want to acknowledge that maybe we have lived with images of the Klan for so long in this country that we've kind of become inured to them, and he doesn't want that to happen. He wants you to be very up close and confront these images, so you will find a very different museum experience in that particular gallery.
We're going to go see it at some point, and I know you're going to go for a longer stay. We should revisit this after all three of us have had a chance to see it.
We're talking to GBH.
100 works, right? 100 works?
Just about. Yeah, okay. And I'll say, because I was there last week doing a lot of shooting, I feel even as much time as I've spent looking at this issue, reading the catalog, which, by the way, was presented before this exhibition was supposed to start in 2020 with a wide array of voices, even as much as I've consumed, I still need to go back and really absorb this show as well.
You know, just as a quick aside, it strikes me how when there are controversial things at museums or things that they're worried will upset the audience, how careful they are about thinking it all through. You know, you go to a movie sometimes and you get in there and you think, oh my God, you had no idea how upsetting some of these movies, but it's a totally different process.
Well, you certainly are aware when you have different voices who finally have the freedom to speak and have the conviction to speak up because they're invited to the table and are able to have a conversation here. One of the things that Terrence Washington said to me is when he was initially brought on, they thought, well, this is a show that needs to counter an answer for the people who rioted in the Capitol. And his point was, are those people coming to this show? Probably not. So we need to be more expansive in our thinking here.
We're talking to Executive Arts Editor here at GBH, Jared Bowen. So I'm going to play a little sound from your Open Studio show the other night when you interviewed Matthew Lopez. He has got this, he's a playwright. And he's got a play right now on the AIDS crisis. It's at the Speakeasy Stage Company. Here is Matthew Lopez with Jared in Open Studio.
I think that it's possible that my generation, having grown up in the shadow of AIDS, are now old enough to really have lived enough of our lives to understand what was lost by it, to understand what it must have felt like to be imperiled by it, to feel always in danger. And, you know, someone who was born in 1977, I was a child when all of this was going on. And now I'm a grown man who's lived longer than many of the people who died of AIDS.
Tell us about his play.
His play is called The Inheritance, and it's playing at Speakeasy Stage Company in two parts through June. And this is, first of all, I'll say it won the Tony Award for Best Play in 2020. It's told in two parts, and Matthew Lopez first encountered Howard's End, the E.M. Forster novel,
yes,
as a film when he was a child. And for some reason, it really deeply resonated within him, and it stuck with him. So he saw the film, he later read the book, and then he did the deep dive into E.M. Forster, whom he learned was closeted, never came out. And so this became, it marinated within him, and eventually out came The Inheritance, which is this two-part play. You can see them, as I did on Sunday, all in one seven-hour marathon session, or you can go on different nights and see both parts. And I will say, this is an extraordinary piece, because this is a story of, as he was just saying, of men in this time, gay men in this time, reconciling a lot. What does it mean to be a gay man now? What is your sense of home? What does it mean to have come after a generation that was nearly virtually wiped out? Because this, in this case, we find a group of gay men living in New York. And I asked him about this. I feel like I'm suddenly reading a lot of stories, seeing television shows, watching documentary treatments on the AIDS crisis, reaching critical mass at this time. And as he was saying, it takes so long to process something like this. Of course, Tony Kushner did this with Angels in America.
Yes, that was 6 hours or 7 hours too, wasn't it?
It was the same. And it feels like now, in its proximity to the AIDS crisis, Angels in America just kind of rocketed out of that. But this is really processing this. And it is a horrible, just devastating thing to think about the number of men who were just wiped off the planet, wiped off of New York City. Because so many of them were in the creative realm, I think, personally, so much about what didn't happen, what legacies don't exist today because these men died. And so this is a major part of this play, is the men contending with that. And he does this through a really fantastic device, too, which is to have E.M. Forster as a character in this play and kind of questioning what these men are doing, but also being interrogated himself for not having more conviction about coming out, which I think some people, younger people, will say, well, why didn't you do more, without necessarily stopping to pause and think everything they were already, what was already weighing them down. He, by the way, is played by Mark H. Dold in just a riveting, riveting performance.
Can we go from the sublime to the, it's borderline ridiculous, I'm embarrassed to ask. 7 hours is a long time. And I'm not quarreling. I know about Angels in America, and I know about this from having read about it. How do you, as brilliant as it is, how do you do 7 hours?
Because it's absorbing.
Really?
7 hours could be awful in the theater if it's a terrible piece, and this is not a terrible piece, because you're so invested in these stories, and it has this rhythm. You say go from the sublime to the ridiculous, and some of it is really raucous, and some of it is hugely heightened sexuality, but there are also these debates. This is a play that is set in the transition from the Obama presidency to the Trump presidency. What does that mean? So there are political discussions, but interwoven again are these themes that I talked about, legacy and home and finding family and bringing together. And I just found it absolutely absorbing. Each play has two intermissions. You can get up and stretch and have a break, but I personally did not find a wasted moment.
How long is it there again?
Through June.
Do some people, how long are the intermissions though? Because I know the Angels in America, some people went out to dinner and then they came back.
Well, that was between the two. I remember doing that in New York. I went across the street to the steakhouse.
Did your kid do that?
Yes,
one
of my kids I got for Christmas, Angels in America.
Yeah, so that's between the two shows. The intermissions are just 15 minutes. But if you see, and I don't think they're doing a lot of full days where you can see both, but you have a couple of hours to grab dinner.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what you do. You go out and have dinner, and then you come back and see the rest.
Yeah. And what's fun is it becomes community, too, because you see the same people in the theater, so you're all coming back together.
Yeah, and people are vaccinated and people are wearing masks.
They're proof of vaccination and wearing masks.
And some of us don't want to see the same people, but that's a whole other discussion.
So tell us what's going on at the Davis Museum at Wellesley College.
We're talking about a lot of heavy stuff today. Prison Nation is an exhibition that's on view at the Davis through June 5th. And this is a project of Nicole Fleetwood, who has looked at the issue of mass incarceration. And here we see it through imagery. So she comes at this from a very personal perspective. She saw over-policing in her community in Ohio, and her cousin was imprisoned. And she would go and visit him. And at the end, they would take pictures with her cousin. And in prison, you have to pay for the picture. And when you don't make a lot of money, you're making cents in prison. The photographs are expensive. But she began to notice that there are backdrops that are created for the prisoners, and it's kind of this way to escape. So that became her launch pad, I think, into this exhibition. And here she curates, along with Amanda Gilvin at the Davis, various photographers looking at the issue of mass incarceration. So you have a person like Jack Luders Booth, who was going out to MCI Framingham in the 1970s, where women could wear their own street clothes in prison, but really fashion their own identities, and he shows that as he gets to know these women. You have Stephen Trelentis, who is right here in Massachusetts, who he does something so clever. He was inspired by Ansel Adams, who did document the Japanese internment camps here in the United States.
Ansel Adams did?
He did, yeah. Yeah, so he was wide-ranging in his landscapes. Wow. And what Stephen Trelentis does is he has gone out to visit family, and he shows you from a distance, you think you're looking at this beautiful landscape with this beautiful Western glow happening in the center, and you get closer to the piece and you realize it's actually the glow of a prison. You know, the Wyoming Death House is what they call it in one of his pieces. In another, you see a prison in what looks like it could be some Edward Hopper-esque escape, where you see a neighborhood in sort of the 1940s-style houses and streets right up against a prison. And there was another piece, another series by the photographer Deborah Luster, where she documents prisoners in a passion play. And they're just a black background. They're in their costumes. And so any notion of prison is completely stripped away. You know, no bars, no uniform, nothing that would suggest where they are. So it forces you to look at these individuals in a different way. I'm leaving aside right now what may have got them to prison, and certainly they're there because they've committed atrocious crimes. But you have to see them differently, and that is very successful in this show.
You're really an upbeat kind of guy. By the way, Ansel Adams, I can't believe these are incredible. I mean, they're really incredible Japanese internment. So, of the remaining, we're a little short on time here. Is there anything left on your thing that is a little upbeat that would leave people
laughing or smiling? Or we can go to Open
Studio. We'll get to that in a second. Can you give us a quick?
You know, the Concord Museum just had this great renovation and expansion. So we just talked about a lot of heavy subjects, but you can go to the Concord Museum and really immerse yourself. What am I talking about? We're talking about revolution and war. There's nothing uplifting
today. You can immerse yourself in war at the Concord Museum.
Nice to see you.
We'll talk about that another
time.
What's
an Open Studio?
You'll see our look at the whole Gustin controversy and what the show looks like today. And last week when I was on with you both, we talked about Don't Eat the Mangoes, that really hilarious play happening at Apollinaire Theater by way of Teatro Chelsea. So we'll sit down with two of the theater artists behind that show.
Can you be a little perkier next week just to help us out? Or?
Poor John Waters. Look what you've done to me before I have to talk to him tonight.
Let me tell you, I love this guy. Every time he's here, I feel like a little something good has happened to us.
I agree.
He is so full of life.
Yeah, it's
amazing.
Great to talk to him. Jared, thank you very much.
It's great to talk to you, too, sometimes. It really is. Occasionally. Oh,
Jared
listen.
Bowen is GBH Executive Vice Editor.
Are happy you were here. Oh, no, there are
he also hosts the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights right here on GBH2. Talk about heavy after a quick break. We're going to open the lines back up again to get more of your reactions to the leaked draft of the Supreme Court's majority decision on overturning Roe v. Wade. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 live from the Boston Public Library. The number is 877-301-8970. You can call or text at that number, or you can email us at bpr@wgbh.org.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. There's not much light to talk about today because obviously this decision is huge. We're at the Boston Public Library. We're streaming on YouTube at youtube.com/GBH News. We're reopening the lines to talk about what everybody in America is talking about, namely this leaked decision, apparent decision from the Supreme Court, in which a 5-member conservative majority planned to overturn Roe v. Wade, 50 years precedent in this country. We want to know what your reaction is to the leak. What do you think this means for America? I'm most interested in what you think the response will be, because one thing I totally agreed with, both with our callers and with Judge Gertner earlier in the show, if the American people just accept this with great sadness and don't do anything about it, then it's an open invitation to people who want to take away our rights in one of the two major parties in this country and on the Supreme Court to just go for it. You heard what Nancy Gertner said. Contraception cases, interracial marriage cases, gay marriage, same-sex marriage cases, are all predicated on the same provisions in the Constitution that this Supreme Court, the majority, thinks doesn't matter. 877-301-8970, and as I hope you've learned in the last week and a half, that is both our call line and our text line.
877-301-8970. Yeah. I'm just looking to see.
Here are a couple of tweets. A text. You want them?
Absolutely.
This is from earlier today. 6474. Now let's make child support start at conception. I would agree with that. 5919. Three justices who were appointed by a president who is still actively seeking to overturn a Democratic election have just overturned a 50-year right for women in this country, which I think is a perfect description of where we are. And as we played for you before, I think one can credibly argue that two very smart people, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, intentionally, I'm being kind, misrepresented their position on precedent, specifically in Roe v. Wade, so that gullible people like Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, would vote for them and have them confirmed to serve the rest of their life on the court.
If she was gullible, if that's just what she wanted to do. I mean, she might have wanted to put Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court. Anyway, I don't know if you mentioned that Mana Raju, the CNN reporter, reached Senator Collins, and this is what she had to say. If this leaked draft opinion is the final decision and this reporting is accurate, which apparently it is now, we have that from the Chief Justice himself. It would be completely inconsistent, she said, with what Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh said in their hearings and in our meetings in my office. The reason I'm suspicious is because Kavanaugh was from the Federalist Society. I believe Gorsuch was from the Federalist Society as well, was he not?
I think every Trump nominee was, right?
They're kind of put together, this group. They knew where they stood on issues, and the most important issue to a lot of them was choice. And they would not have been put forward by the Federalist Society were they not against abortion rights.
By the way, there's a lot of speculation. One of the texters earlier in the day from Maine, I can't remember her name, said she believes there's evidence, she didn't say what it was, that the deal was cut between Mitch McConnell and her. You vote for, I can't remember, I think it was Kavanaugh, in return for which we will continue funding for the Bath Iron Works. Now, I have no idea if that was a deal, but one Mainer suggested a few minutes ago it was. Let's try to take some calls in our remaining minutes.
Sally in Somerville, thank you for calling.
Hello, Sally.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. It is really tough what's happening right now. I just want to say that I'd like the media to emphasize the religious tyranny aspect of this Republican Party and this agenda that's been in process for several decades. And I also just want to say I'm really disappointed that the Obama administration did not sue Mitch McConnell, for not allowing Merrick Garland a hearing. I think our Constitution is broken, and we need a new Constitution, a new constitutional convention, because clearly the one that was ratified more than 200 years ago by a small group of white landowning men, a small group of voters at the time, doesn't work now. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you for the call. You know, by the way, I wanted to add one thing to what Judge Gertner told us before around the whole question that, you know, the right to privacy on which Roe v. Wade is built isn't in the Constitution. There's a terrific piece in the Washington Post by this woman, Laura Briggs, who says the silence is what Alito seized upon to write the decision, the purported decision that they'll adopt and release to the public in June. But what if the Constitution, she writes, was silent on abortion because its drafters believe that it, like virtually all medical procedures, should remain unregulated as a matter of law? And she quotes James Wilson, wrote the Constitution's preamble, quoting William Blackstone, obviously an expert on English common law, who makes that very point. So an originalist, Alito, and his four colleagues chose to find what they wanted to find to reach their predetermined goal, which was taking away some pretty basic rights from women in this country.
Let's go to Liza in Rhode Island. Thank you for calling, Liza.
Hey, Liza.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Just real briefly, going on with, I'm 10 minutes away from where William Blackstone's tree is planted. Anyway, there is a march this evening at 5 o'clock at every judicial good marches, I should say, plural. The Women's March, I've just got a notification that, and they're asking everyone to go, and there are a lot of people are organizing to go to every judicial building in this country, regardless of your location, 5 o'clock this evening.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Liza.
Yes,
we really appreciate
you.
It.
And I'm also getting a text message talking about the Boston Red Cloaks sponsoring a protest on the State House steps this weekend. For more information, you go to their Facebook page. So I think there are going to be a lot of protests about. I mean, that was basically what the Women's March was about after Trump was elected, where women showed up with their little pink pussy hats on the buses.
I remember
and
well.
Drove all over the country to get there.
So, Marjorie, we mentioned to Judge Gertner a poll that appeared on the CNN screen from
right.
January of this year. 69% opposed the Supreme Court dumping Roe v. Wade. A mere 30% supported it. We know that conservative voters in this country are quite often single-issue voters on things like guns, whatever. Can you imagine, is there a voter out there who was on, let's say, on the fence, not somebody who was ready to vote for J.D. Vance in Ohio or can't wait till Donald Trump declares his candidacy for re-election for 2024? Can you describe the independent voter, probably a woman, who said I was on the fence, but now I'm voting for people who want to protect my right to choose?
Well, I would think that the independent voter would be a woman who maybe has had an abortion herself, because millions of women have had abortions. A quarter of women have had abortions in the United States by the time they reach age 45.
Yeah.
Or is a woman who is worried about her ability to use birth control, or worried about her own daughter's ability to use birth control. I mean, it can't be emphasized enough. As we've said, and emailers are saying, and texters are saying, this could be the tip of the iceberg. These justices are going to be on the Supreme Court for a very, very long time, and the underpinning of Roe has to do with the underpinning of the Griswold decision on abortion, contraception.
Obergefell.
Obergefell, thank you. Decision on gay marriage and the Loving decision on interracial marriage. So they're all kind of linked. I mean, is this where we're headed? Are we going to go backwards on gay marriage?
And a former president with his allies in Congress tried to overturn a Democratic election, or still
right.
trying to overturn it. Did you see a sea change of opinion amongst independent voters who said, I love what the Republican Party stands for, but this is a bridge too far?
Well, you know, I think, as I've said a million times, we have a very divided country in terms of their media sources.
Uh-huh.
You know, the New York Times did a brilliant interactive piece on Tucker Carlson.
That
if you go to their website, you can see how many times you talked about us versus them, you know, us or you versus them. And the yous were all his audience, which is mostly elderly white people, and the them is everybody else. And talking, you know, like in these hysterical terms about these plots against the yous by all the thems. And he's the number one guy on cable news, and that kind of stuff gets regurgitated all through the conservative websites. So people get worked up about that kind of stuff. And frankly, I think that there are a lot of people. I mean, what do we talk about on Twitter? That what are people so afraid of? They're afraid of people going after people of color and people going after women.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of animus toward women in the United States of America, obviously. Otherwise, people wouldn't vote for politicians who've been credibly accused by multiple women of sexual assault, but we do. So.
Well, but again, I'm hoping I'm wrong in terms of the reaction to abortion, reaction to the attempt to overturn an election. I'm not putting this in that category. I think that New York Times series, which is this multimedia brilliant thing, makes the case slam dunk that the most popular host on cable news is a white supremacist. How many Republicans do you know who've called out Tucker Carlson for his white supremacy in the last 3 days?
I don't know a single one.
I mean, I worry that nothing matters anymore, that people are so polarized, they're so locked in, that as seismic as this decision should and will be, that it's going to matter to those who misbehavior already matters.
Here's an email from Matt, a headline of which is, the complacency of the left and the complicity of the middle are both to blame. For years now, the left, Democratic voters, and politicians have been far too complacent about the Supreme Court, which is true. Those people who say they're in the middle as voters are also complicit in rendering women as second-class citizens in this country. Republicans, led by Emperor McConnell, have been hell-bent on making this day a reality for decades. Anyone who sat on the sidelines during 2016 or voted as a swing voter for Trump because Hillary wasn't good enough for them should feel deep shame today.
One more thing before we get back to the calls. When we spoke to Nancy Gertner, she agreed on a couple of things. One, that if the Republicans take the House and the Senate and the presidency in 24-25, they could pass a law outlawing abortion nationally, which would override the Roe Act that passed here over Charlie Baker's veto in December of 2020, which would outlaw abortion even here. However, she went on to say that she and her husband, who's the former legal director for the ACLU, John Reinstein, did a case that established a constitutional right to an abortion. It's not mentioned in any local media here today. However, even Nancy Gertner admitted, as the one of the two people behind that case, that if the Congress were to declare that a fetus has personhood, that she believes there was at least a colorable legal argument that would even override the constitutional protection here in Massachusetts. The point of this monologue by me is, if you're in Massachusetts and you're only feeling empathetic towards your brothers and sisters in 49 other states, you better worry about Massachusetts as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, anti-abortion people have been talking about personhood for years now, and it's been a real effort that they've tried to get traction on. Patricia from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, Patricia. Welcome.
Hello?
Hi. You're on.
Oh, okay. That was quick. Yeah, I say San Antonio, but I'm from Massachusetts. I've been here for 2 years.
So great. We're glad to have you. What's up?
I'm 74 years old. When I was 21, a senior in college, pregnant, and I ended up having an illegal abortion, and it was, I can't even talk about it now, just awful. And what bothers me is that all these people who were anti, you know, want to overturn Roe v. Wade and all that, don't think of what that would, projection of that. If I wanted to have the baby and give it up, it wouldn't be a nice, comfortable adoption like this Phoenix person in the judge.
Tony Barrett,
says.
Barrett.
Oh, okay. The kids were put in orphanages. There were so many of them. And the likelihood that they're getting into a nice home was not, you know, was not very good. It wasn't as clean and pretty as people make it sound now. And that's what our future would be if this happened. And how are we going to, and what about the poverty, the women who can't afford to keep them, know they can't, and giving up a child is very unselfish, and having an abortion is a very unselfish act because they know they can't properly take care of the child. But we don't. Nothing has been talked about that. What about these women who have to have this child, know they can't afford it? What kind of help are they going to be given?
Well, Patricia, thank you very much for that
call.
I mean, Patricia raises a great point. The major reason why women have abortions is poverty. Mm-hmm. That's the major reasons. Most women who have abortions are already mothers, and they cannot afford to have any more children. And this idea that it's a form of birth control for teenagers is just ridiculous. And by the way, Planned Parenthood, which the right has been trying to shut down for years now, is the major reason why the number of abortions in the United States have gone down, because women can get birth control through Planned Parenthood at a very reasonable cost. And again, it's a lot of poor women. I don't know how many people have ever been to a Planned Parenthood, but they are not, you know, we're not talking about swank places. I remember the places where the shootings were right here in Brookline. They are places where a lot of the people there are poor women. In fact, I covered an abortion, actually, watched a woman getting an abortion there, and she was in tears the whole time. She was a mother of two. And she had been on welfare, and she'd just gotten a job, and she knew if she had this baby, because there is no maternity leave help then, it's a little bit better now, there isn't any child care help, she would not have been able to take care of her other children without going back on welfare. And she had an abortion there without anesthesia, because it was $200 more to get the anesthesia. So these are tragic stories. I mean, somebody said before, I shouldn't call abortion sad. Well, I stand by that. I do think it's sad. It's not a happy thing, but it's a thing that is, the government has got no business telling that mother or any other mother what she should do.
Linda in Framingham, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We appreciate your call. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I'm short-term listener, but I love your program, first-time caller. And what motivated me to call was that I have a piece in the Brumfield Gallery right now. I'm an artist. Oh. And it's based on my experience in the 60s working as an RN in an intensive care gynecology unit in Philadelphia, where the majority of my patients, who were women, of course, were septic abortions. Mm. And they were because they had no safe, clean, positive experience. And I want to plug Planned Parenthood, because it's not just about abortion. It's about giving women the opportunity to have birth control and have lives. So I'm very passionate about it. So the piece is at Brumfield Gallery. It's called Home Remedies, Pre-Roe v. Wade.
That's on Harrison Ave, yes?
Yes, it is. It's in the Sowa District.
Great.
Linda, thank
you
for the
thanks
call.
For sharing the that
only,
as well.
The only bright light in this whole disaster, is, as we talked about with Nancy Gertner, is that there are medical abortions now. And members of the GOP, certainly these legislators,
you mean medication.
Have tried medication abortion, right. And that you can, I think it's very hard to patrol people's mailboxes to outlaw that kind of thing.
But it's a hell of a way to have to live. To have control over your own life is to rely upon the fact that it's unlikely they're going to be policing your mailbox.
Women don't have freedom if they don't have reproductive freedom. If you cannot make a choice about a pregnancy, you have no freedom. And again, we're not, with all these people that are shutting down abortion, what are they doing to make it easier for poor women to have babies or anybody to have babies? Nothing.
You know, I want to say something I said earlier before we leave today, too, is while the conventional wisdom is this is politically of help to the Democrats have to have their feet held to the fire, too. They could make abortion legal nationally by statute in Congress. The House has already voted on that. If the two Democrats who oppose carving out an exception to the filibuster, that is obviously the man from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema, agreed to carve out this one exception to the filibuster. So Democrats alone have the power to make a difference here, and they should be held to account as well. So that's it. We're done.
Yeah. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Sorry it was a little bit downbeat, but this was a tough
day. Well, it was upbeat in spots.
It was upbeat in spots.
We had some moments. Thank you all.
Anyway, you can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by the ACLU's Carol Rose. We'll talk to her about this ruling as well. Podcast critic Nick Quay. We're very thrilled to talk to
him. Oh,
great. Nick Quay. Excuse me. And Dr. Virginia Sinnott Stussman for her Ask the Vet. Juliet Kime and Art Kaplan will be with us as well. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber. Our engineer is John McClaw Parker. Our producer, our executive producer, is Jamie Bologna. We want to give special thanks to our engineering team, Taya Modaliz, Eddie Hickey, Rob Fagnett, and Angela Marrero.
Remember when Dr. Stutzman was here last and she said she refers to dogs as a nose on four legs? I thought that was... She's fabulous. Any question you have, that'll be a little more upbeat.
That's right. You can call
tomorrow.
With your pet questions tomorrow. Yeah.
So I'm off tonight, but Sue O'Connell, the great Sue O'Connell, is sitting in. She's going to talk to about, obviously, the abortion decision. And if you want to see him rather than just hear him, the wonderful John Waters with a new book out today will be joining Sue as well. That's tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
And at 6 o'clock, he'll be interviewed at the Brattle Theater by Jared Bowen.
It's unbelievable how this works, isn't it?
It is. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you again for tuning in today. Thank you to people that came down to the library.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
And hope you can tune in again tomorrow and have a great day.